Arcade. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop renewable. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, and welcome to the second broadcast of this first full week of September. I'm Bob, this is The Horn, and I certainly hope you will enjoy your time with us this evening. I certainly will enjoy my time with you. This is my favorite part of the day, and, well, this has been... over the course of what will soon be 6 years, on October the 24th, 6 years, this has been the most meaningful, most amazing period of my life. Suffice to say, it means a lot to me to be able to get behind the microphone and talk with you. I've been sort of, you know how I go about doing show prep on any given day. It starts in the morning and it generally doesn't end until 10 or 15 and sometimes 5 minutes before airtime. Things just pop up that way. And so I never really know what shape or what form the show is going to take until sometimes right as the intro is running. And it can change over the course of the program itself. That's one of the more refreshing things to me about being able to do this the way we do it, is not being all married up to a format or a schedule or anything like that. It affords a certain freedom to let the conversation go where it will, and this is, after all, conversation radio. If it is not conversant, it ain't The Horn. So, with that having been said, the question arises as the chat room begins to fill up. If you've never been to the chat room at headonradionetwork.com, now is an excellent time to pop in and try it out. It is, of course, free for you to use. Easy to sign up, easy to register, easy to get in, and go, 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 go. Great conversation going on in there. Like I said, folks are slowly filtering in. It's the top of the program, and things will get going pretty good as the show progresses. So pop in if you never have. If you're new to The Horn, it won't take you long to figure out what conversation radio means. It means that you are now engaged in a genuine dialogue that has nothing to do with selling bowling balls that can be picked up by vacuum cleaners and dropped on Swedish mattresses where people rest who have paid for their survival seeds and their food insurance and are relaxing with an herbally induced growth of hair on their bald little pates and a big old herbally induced erection. None of that. Cool, right? Yeah, I thought so too. That's conversation radio. And certainly it is every bit as much about you or more about you than it is about me. But at the top of the program, I'd like to give you a couple of little heads-up thingamajigs. A reminder, starting on Tuesday of next week, I will be gone Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. That's all of next week except Monday. With that in mind, we will either be reruns or if I can twist his arm at a great distance, we'll see if John Fox can maybe do a couple of fill-in gigs. I frankly don't know because John is staying right thoroughly busy these days. So we'll just have to see how it goes. Now, everybody don't disappear. I mentioned something to you last night by way of trying to figure out a way to make the Horn's fundraising a little bit easier on everyone concerned. I mentioned a little idea that I'm calling the Thrifty 250. The Thrifty 250 is what we hope will be a group of 250 people who subscribe and contribute $10 a month to the Horn to keep the lights on, to keep things going. And that would do so very, very, very nicely. And as it turns out, if you want to figure out an hourly rate for that, $10 per person per month works out to about 5 cents an hour if we were actually paying wages. 5 cents an hour for Ben Birch, John Fox, and me combined. It works out to about a penny an hour if you include, as we probably should, Lottie in the chat room, Gene and Susan, the News Ninjas, Matt Osborne, Reverbo, my head writer David in Tennessee, our blogger Texas Betsy, and everybody who makes this program go. Yeah, it works out to about a penny an hour. So at that rate, I would think that maybe, given the number of people who listen to this program, which is substantial, I would think that it might be, I would hope that it would be easy for folks to say, a penny an hour? Dang! And jump in and become part of the process that keeps the Horn going. And it looks like it may turn out to have been a good idea. Ultimately, what we will do is we'll put a little box on the headonradionetwork.com website. First names and first name, last initial only. No city location, no last names, nothing like that. For people who have decided to join up with the Thrifty 250. Because just counting, it looks like a workable idea. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 21, and this is kind of odd for this time of month. I mean, we're just barely a full week into the month of September. And we are well over halfway toward the number of people who usually contribute to the program. The Nifty 250 seems to be taking off quite nicely. And, of course, there are others in there, and thank you very much to you, who have contributed significantly more than 10 bucks. You're carrying the weight for folks who otherwise can't. It doesn't seem like 10 bucks is a whole lot of money, but there are folks who simply cannot, and you're carrying that weight. This is a great step forward. So, you know, if we figure that we're about 40 people into the Thrifty 250, that means we only need 210 more people to step up, and we're done. And once we know that, the whole fundraising thing becomes considerably simpler. There's another thing out there that will make fundraising considerably simpler. You may recall a couple of weeks ago I had an on-air conversation, because I'm a big fan of the show, with Anthony Bourdain. Well, on Monday nights, I didn't last night, at least not at first, because I spent the first hour listening to the debut of the Rick Smith Show coming from central Pennsylvania. And it was a great first outing. I think there are wonderful things that are going to be happening for the Rick Smith Show going forward into the future. And he'll be with us tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern Time as well, and every night after my program. So, look forward to that. Plan around it. Ben is setting up the podcast and the archives, all of that. And it will eventually expand to a full 3 hours. It was a great, you know, there are some wrinkles to be ironed out, but you know what, like I said, it was almost 6 years ago that we cranked this up, and it was all wrinkle. There were no flat spots to start. It was all wrinkles. But we got most of them ironed out. Here and there, I forget which buttons to push, and every now and then Mother Nature takes us down. But Mother Nature does that as a way of just sort of keeping us honest. Check out the Rick Smith Show again tonight and going forward. And for those of you who love listening to Malloy as I do, it's always worth remembering that you can catch him live from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. On any given day, except Fridays when he's live in the regular time slot. And there's always archiving and podcasting. You know, this is the new media. You can listen when you want. And that's what's ever so important. Anyway, so you probably heard the conversation with Anthony Bourdain. I watched his Paris episode last night. It was his 100th episode. They went back to Paris because his first episode was Paris. It was a wonderful show. It's about the only television I ever talk about because it's smart and it's humane. I think that's the thing. It's not about, oh, look, he's going to eat a snake. No, it's about how humane, how utterly human Mr. Bourdain is in the way he approaches other peoples, other cultures, other food ways, other life ways, folk ways, what have you. And so, lo and behold, it just turned out that I found out last night, and this has been going on since July, so we're a little bit kind of behind the eight ball. But it's one of those things that we can participate in together because it's fun. I posted it on my Facebook page earlier today. There is an essay contest out there. The website is Bourdain, B-O-U-R-D-A-I-N, Medium Raw being the name of his new book, BourdainMediumRaw.com. And there is an essay contest in which one writes the answer to the question, why cook well? Well, we all know that I'm a food freak and a cooking junkie and whatever we want to call me. I don't like foodie because it just seems so, I don't know, so insubstantial. It's like, no. But we do talk about a good bit of food porn here on the program. Because it's one of those things that really does link us together as human beings. And, you know, I've mentioned from time to time that, for instance, Dennis in Kentucky, he and I mow the grass out of his place a lot together on the podcast. I have found out last week that John and I wash potsherds in New York from time to time on the podcast. I found out earlier today that Corey and I and you and me and we, all of us, well, Bob, you do help count the nightly deposit at the Clown Store, passing off as a fast food restaurant most nights when I can't listen live. And that's Corey in Louisville. You got to say it like that, Louisville. We do all kinds of things together. And one of the first things I found out that we all do together is we all have dinner at Scott and Linda's up in Massachusetts every night. I suspect they're probably listening now. And so that whole sort of food supper time aspect, because this is happening at 6 o'clock Eastern time on the PM on the East Coast, it's dinner time. My dinner is usually later. It's part of why I weigh too much, because I eat and then go to bed, and that's never a great way to lose weight. But because I can't stand going on there after I've had a big meal. Oh, go and get me a bucket. You know, yuck. But I'm pretty sure that we've ruined several meals for Scott and Linda, among others, you know, talking about gross things. But it also serves to play up the fact that this program goes to a lot of fascinating places. Do you know that this program has been on the bottom of the ocean? I kid you not. It was a while back when I received a photograph taken from a robotic submersible vehicle of a little baby volcano being born. And that photograph was taken while the horn was out at sea with the individual who was listening. It amazes me. We do all kinds of things, you and I, here at the horn, in folks' ordinary and everyday lives. It's beautiful. It is truly beautiful. There's Scott in Sweden who takes his beloved dogs walking in snow that's deeper than they are tall while listening to the podcast. It is amazing to me sitting here in the hills and hollers of West Virginia and with a travel bug not just biting me but gnawing my butt off that will likely never be satiated. Not a lot of travel available to me or mine or my family. But you have been kind enough to take us with you. And that is a joy. And that's part of the reason I enjoy watching No Reservations. But anyway, there's an essay contest. Did I tell you there's an essay contest over at Medium Raw, BourdainMediumRaw.com? Well, there is. And I found out about it last night. And, you know, ordinarily, I don't forward chain letters, and I don't enter contests, and I don't do any of that stuff. But in this case, I did. Why cook well? And upon hitting send, had to be 500 words. You know, you listen to the program, you know, I can't say my name in less than 500 words. we're probably well over 1,000 words already in the program, and the program's less than 15 minutes old. But this time I entered. Not just because there's a $10,000 prize that goes with it, because the winning essay will be published in the back end pages of the paperback version of Medium Raw, which is really cool. One of the things that I really appreciate about Tony Bourdain is the fact that he notes in talking about the genesis of this essay contest, he notes that he got his big break because he had written something that he thought no one else would read, and somebody published it and gave him a chance, and everything took off, and he said, I want to do that for somebody else. Hello, Mr. Bourdain, I'm over here. So I wrote the essay. And if you look, if you're friended with me on Facebook, and if you're on Facebook and you're not friended with me, why not? Bob Kincaid. It's real simple. Bob Kincaid. Same thing with Twitter. Twitter. Bob Kincaid. I acknowledge and confirm all friend requests. But I posted the link to it over on my Facebook page, and I posted it on Twitter as well. And here, right now, even as we speak, I'm going to post it at the chat room. And there it is. Because the way this works, you have to get it where it's going. I can't do it. I'm not even allowed to vote for my own essay, which I think is fair. I started out this morning having hit submit. I started out at number 1582. I'm up to number 549, and that's with only 6 votes. Only 6 votes today. My goodness gracious, you get the votes going there, and no telling where this could go. Now, here's the tough part. This contest has been going on since early July, and the woman who is in first place has something on the order of nearly 5,000 votes. Apparently, she leveraged 8,000 friends on Facebook from a salsa dancing club, so I don't feel bad about telling you guys about it. But we've got from now until September the 30th to spread the word around. Hey, everybody vote for Bob's essay. Not because of Bob's ego, but because it's one of those little things we can do as a group together, as a Horn family, and make good things happen for us all. Because you know what? The winning the prize money would, like I said, allow me to shut up the fundraising business for about 4 months. And that would be great. Plus, I'm kind of proud of the little piece that I wrote. I'll share it with you here in a couple of minutes. Remember, the topic was why cook well. And remember, you can vote every day. So you've got if everybody goes and votes every day, this should be a landslide. 10% of the judging criteria is based on who wins the popularity contest online. The other 90% is made up of other stuff, like having good grammar and knowing what a gerund is. Well, I'm screwed. But anyway, if you're into it, I remember when this happened with Netroots Nation. It was very, very cool 2 years ago. It would be awesome if we could pull this off again. It would be big fun. And you know what, if nothing else, it was fun to write. Because I do think about, as you know, listening to this program, I do think about things like this outside the box, so to speak. I think about them in terms of the overall import to us as the scrabbling little species that we have been on this planet for what is a relatively short span of time. I got to thinking, among other things, about telling you guys about this essay business when I saw a post from the inimitable Susie Madrak over at Crooks and Liars earlier today. Headline, FDA-approved Frankenfish coming to a supermarket near you, At 7 a.m. before breakfast, before even so much as the first cup of coffee. That is a real generator. Trust me. Oh, goody. as if the genetically modified corn and the genetically modified cattle and the genetically modified bovine growth hormone and the downer cattle that wind up in your Dinty Moore beef stew wasn't enough. We're getting frankenfish. Water bad. What? The Food and Drug Administration, this is the portion of the story that Susie Madrax cited at Crooks and Liars, the Food and Drug Administration is poised to approve the first genetically modified animal for human consumption, a highly anticipated, by whom, decision that is, by the corporate salmon, franken-salmon industry, I guess, that is stirring controversy and could mark a turning point in the way American food is produced. Oh, I think we've already had that turning point. Most of what we eat now in any given mood or any given moment, especially if you're going through the drive-through somewhere, is mostly, as Michael Pollan noted in The Omnivore's Dilemma, a combination of corn and diesel fuel. Mm-mm. Hey, Grandpa, what's for supper? Yeah, the first fully modified for human consumption fish. Because, you know, the way they've evolved in the sea over the years just ain't good enough. What's next? Beakless chickens? Oh, wait. You know, we've always messed with, it's called animal husbandry. Probably for much more vivid reasons than you or I ever want to contemplate, going back to a day when the vivid reasons for calling it that, well, let's not. It's dinner time in Massachusetts. Good goat will do that. That's a punchline, you know. FDA scientists gave a boost last week to the Massachusetts company, sorry, that wants federal approval to market a genetically engineered salmon, or as they say down south where I grew up, salmon. No, really. Salmon, declaring that the altered salmon is safe to eat and does not pose a threat to the environment. Food from AquaVantage salmon, yeah. Oh, where's that marketing department? The AquaVantage salmon. What, GL, LS, LX? Is as safe to eat as food from other Atlantic salmon, the FDA staff wrote in a briefing document. Never mind the fact that other Atlantic salmon, if you eat it very much more than a couple of times a month, will have you mattered in the hatter from the coal filth generated mercury that's already in it. Oh, God. These findings will be presented September 19th to a panel of scientific experts, which will advise top officials at the FDA whether to approve the altered salmon. Altered salmon. Altered states. Does this mean that after you eat the salmon, the walls are going to start breathing and you're going to see some paisley skies? I frankly don't know. Those findings will be presented September 19th to a panel of scientific experts which will advise top officials at the FDA whether to approve the altered salmon. The panel is holding 2 days of meetings to hear from FDA staff, the company behind AquaVantage, and the public. Notice how the public is mentioned last on that list. Who is the company behind AquaVantage salmon? Which sounds surprisingly like awkward salmon. Three eyes. Homer! Don't! Really? Who's the company? Blackwater? Z? Halliburton? General Electric? We bring good fish to life? What? AquaVantage is an Atlantic salmon that has been given a gene from the ocean pout? Well, screw me, I had no idea there was a fish called a pout. I thought a pout was something that my 13-year-old puts on because I won't get her a cell phone. Daddy, you don't want a cell phone. Of course, if you think about it, that kind of mouth turned down at the corner, smile turned upside down, sort of pout frown kind of thing. It kind of looks like the mouth of a salmon, doesn't it? Yeah. Disturbing. No, it has a gene from the ocean pout, an eel-like fish. You know, who was it? Oh, God, it was one of the... Where is Eugene Finnerman when I need him most? It was one of the English kings. Come on, somebody knows the king list. Got himself offed. Started the anarchy, I think is what it was called. Between Stephen and some woman. English king got himself off because he was eating poison eels. See where this stuff takes my mind? It's a real burden having a thin but working knowledge of history. Anyway, these Atlantic salmon have been given a gene from the ocean pout, an eel-like fish, which allows the salmon to grow twice as fast as a traditional Atlantic salmon. It also contains a growth hormone from a Chinook salmon. So in other words, we are essentially giving the salmon the same damn thing that Roger Clemens has been indicted for injecting into his own Butox. Right? Right. How inspiring. Oh, there's the company that started Aqua Advantage. Why, it's Aqua Bounty. The quicker fisher-upper. Aqua Bounty, the Massachusetts company that first applied to the FDA for permission to sell its fish in 1995, said the modified fish is identical to the Atlantic salmon except for the speed of its growth and the baby's arm growing out of their heads. I'm sorry, I added the part about the baby's heads.
We've been studying this fish for more than 10 years, said Ronald L. Stotish, the company's president and chief executive. In characteristics, physiology, behavior, this is an Atlantic salmon. It looks like an Atlantic salmon, it tastes like an Atlantic salmon, and speaks three different languages fluently, including pouty eel.
So I guess, is that the new FDA standard? If it swims like a fish and it looks like a fish, it's a fish? Because, see, there's no way in the world you could make a salmon, get it on with a pouty eel, and come up with the Aqua Advantage fish with a baby's arm growing out of its head. And apparently, I'm not the only one who's concerned about this. The team of scientists at the FDA that reviewed Aqua Bounty's application seems to agree. We have found no biologically relevant difference between food from Aqua Bounty salmon and conventional Atlantic salmon, the briefing document said. Oopsie, independent scientists, see, they're independent. There's going to be nothing but trouble. Independent scientists, consumer groups, and environmental organizations are concerned about both the pending decision and the process that the FDA uses to determine whether the genetically modified fish is safe for human health and the environment. Because remember, and this is a little bit complicated, I don't mean it to be, remember that there's something out there called rapeseed. But you could never market rapeseed oil, no matter how handy and convenient it is, and no matter what high temperatures under which it still does not smoke, and it's handy for frying. So they licensed it and branded it and called it canola. Got a jug of it in the kitchen right now. Handier than hell. But that stuff is genetically modified, and it's got little genetic markers in it to let you know that Monsanto, or who the hell ever, crafted it and created it. And it grows wild along roadsides in Canada now. And it will eventually take the place. The same thing with the genes from that genetically modified number 2 field grade Roundup Ready corn that now is developed. It's, you know, God, you gotta love nature. You put out there corn that can't be killed by ordinary weeds and the herbicides will take it down. Nature's gonna evolve them some weeds that it can't. And the next thing you know, Monsanto's in catch-up mode, trying to figure out what we're going to do to catch the mice, to catch the snakes that ate the mice, and now then you're up to elephants and you're screwed. Actually, once you get to elephants, you're back to mice. And it's really silly. But the fact of the matter is, just the same as this corn and the rapeseed and so forth spreads its genetic material into other vulnerable, untainted varieties. Are these Atlantic salmon going to be sterile? Are they going to be incapable of breeding? What if one gets out for a randy Saturday night and gets it on with a regular Atlantic salmon? Oh, baby, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm clean. I had my test. Yeah, let's spawn. Well, there goes your natural salmon population, and then if something happened, turns out to be with the frankenfish. Oops! Here's the fun part. You know, I told you about those hearings that were going to take place that were going to feature FDA scientists and Aqua Bounty, the Fisher Picker-Upper. And, you know, the public. Well, this is the fun part. The agency, the FDA, is evaluating the fish as if it were new, The agency is evaluating the fish as if it were a new veterinary drug. What does that mean for you, for me? Well, that means that the FDA's deliberations are behind closed doors. Why are the deliberations behind closed doors? And because if this fish is perfectly safe, it's just like any other Atlantic salmon! Well, it's behind closed doors because Aqua Bounty is claiming much of the research and other supporting data it's supplying to the FDA as confidential in nature. You know, the parts about the baby's arms that grow out of the salmon, or the talking at the salmon, or the, you know, Mr. Limpet becomes a salmon. What was it? Mr. Limpet was more of a tuna, wasn't he? Quote, critical information about the whole process has been kept from the public and organizations that focus on these issues. Well, I used the wrong voice for that. That was Winona Howder, executive director of Food and Water Watch. They're part of a coalition of 31 organizations and restaurant chefs demanding that the FDA deny approval of the frankenfish. There's a transparency problem. Jesus, don't say that, Winona. They'll genetically modify a transparent salmon. That I don't want to see. It's cute in those little itty-bitty fish in the aquarium, but no, I don't want to. Just don't want to. Can't. Just can't. Gross. So anyway, all of that contributed to what I wrote for the Bourdain essay contest. Because I got to thinking about the commonality that we as all, the one thing we have all have in common is the necessity that we consume food and water and breathe air. You find me a human being that says they don't do one of them, and don't send me the story about the 87-year-old yogi who's lying to the world and saying he hasn't eaten in 47 years, liar. No, I saw that episode. I saw that scene from Monty Python and Monty Python's Life of Brian. No, I'll pass. Juniper berries. That's the key. But it's what we have in common. And I got to thinking about how it is that. Well, here, I'll just read it to you. I titled the piece "Dancing Around the Monolith with a Spoon." Anthropologists delight in speculating about that singular moment when we, as humans, became human. They talk of tool-making, of art. They're wrong. It's cooking. And cooking well that set us up the next rung on the evolutionary ladder. Our proto-human ancestors, forced from the trees by a changing world. Remember the conversation we had last week about what the Sahara used to be as compared to what it is now? Our proto-human ancestors, forced from the trees by a changing world, were more prey than predator. Vague, hirsute resemblances aside, you need a bath and a shave, Cheetah, they were no one we'd invite over for cocktails. There's not a lot human about animals who duke it out with the weasels, wombats, and buzzards for what the lions and hyenas didn't find appetizing. For that matter, being the appetizer isn't particularly human either. We begin to recognize our ancient relatives in that moment when we see them paying more attention to what they ate. Even if, and it's true of all our relatives, some more than others, sorry Adam Richman, even if that carefully prepared meal was neighbor au poivre, we can mark that moment of humanity on the upswing when we went from simply gnawing on Ned next door to wanting old Ned to taste a little less, well, Neddy. That desire to eat better yielded the urge to see what fire could do with the day's catch of critter. As our proto-pals proved, you can get through a winter without fire. What you can't do is cook. Those cave paintings in France and Spain, those weren't sacred or mysterious. Those were kitchen notes. First, Oog ride spotted pony to get gazelle. Picture of spotted pony and gazelle. Oog cook gazelle. Soot stains on cave ceiling. Oog serve 12 five tops. Oog's 12 handprints on a wall. Oog have to serve cranky vegetarian. Picture of grass and flowers. Vegetarians. Handprint on a handprint with only one finger showing, and you know which one. That's the moment. From the instant we stuck the raw bloody meat in the fire, we began to change. Brow ridges receded, our chins emerged, and cue the 2001 music, we became less ape-like. That means more room for a brain inside the skull. That means more thinking. From that first human with the bigger brain to Julia Child is a relatively small leap in time, and we honor them all every time we check the soup to see what it needs to make it taste better. Oh, we still have our pre-Oog wombat wrestlers. They're standing in line, McClowns or Burger Thing, as I write. Their pancreases, rotten with high fructose corn syrup, wanting that cheap sugar blast like Keith Richards waking up jonesing after Altamont. But here's the deal. We who insist on cooking well, whether we're shucking an oyster or braising a shank, are all that stands between us and a fast-food-induced end of civilization as we know it. To cook well is to be human well. We owe it not only to ourselves, but to all the Oogs and their buddies who thought well enough of us to get civilized themselves. We're homo coquens. The cooking human. And thus it is that we find ourselves started up for this Tuesday night edition of The Horn. You know how to reach the program, right? 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel, 304-658-3333. Email comes in to Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, @gmail.com. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice, headonradionetwork.com. This is The Horn, and I'm Bob.
I've been thinking lately about the people I meet, the car wash on the corner and the hole in the street, the way my ankles hurt with shoes on my feet, and I'm wondering if I'm gonna see tomorrow. Father, forgive us for what we must do. You forgive us, we'll forgive you. We'll forgive each other till we both turn blue, then we'll whistle and go fishing in heaven. I was in the army, but I never dug a trench. Used to bust my knuckles on a monkey wrench. I go to town and drink, give the girls a pinch, but I don't think they ever even notice me. Father, forgive us for what we must do. You forgive us, we'll forgive you. We'll forgive each other till we both turn blue. Then we'll whistle and go fishing in heaven. Fish and whistle, a whistle and fish. Eat everything that they put on your dish. And when we get blue, we'll make a big wish that we never have to do this again. Again, again. Oh. my very first job, I said, thank you and please. They made me scrub a parking lot down on my knees. Then I got fired for being scared of bees, and they only give me 50 cents an hour. Father, forgive us for what we must do. You forgive us, we'll forgive you. We'll forgive each other till we both turn new. Then we'll whistle and go fishing in heaven. Whistle and fish, eat everything that they put on your dish. And when we get through, we'll make a bigger wish that we never have to do this again. Again, again. Oh, Father, forgive us for what we must do. You forgive us, we'll forgive you. We'll forgive each other till we both turn new. Then we'll whistle and go fishing in heaven. We'll whistle and go fishing in heaven. We'll whistle and go fishing in the heaven.
Hell, for all I know, that genetically modified salmon can do its own whistling. Maybe it's a whistling fish. Never mind fish and whistle. God, I love John Prine. Maybe it's a whistling fish. I just, for the life of me, I can't come up with anything that I would like, that I think didn't. And understand, I'm not a scientific Luddite. I don't oppose genetic research by any stretch of the imagination. I would like to know that there's a refrigerator out there somewhere where the spare part's me in it. I'm a West Virginian. I want a me up on blocks that I can get the hubcaps off of. Or a heart, or set of lungs that my body's not going to reject. Hey, he's not using it. Well, you know, we're not going to, he's not going to make you conscious or anything. So, you know, questions coming in, Ron and Raleigh asking, hey, Bob, what have those fish been modified to do? Ride a bicycle? Yeah, that's the point. And everybody chiming in on the English king. No, Marty suggesting Edward VI. No, no. As Ron notes, it was King Henry I. Yes, it was. And he died from eating a surfeit of lampreys. And you see, medical science was not very well advanced at that point in time. So the lamprey scope had not been... The lamprey scope had not been invented, and therefore they couldn't tell what was wrong with him. But if you know, if you also know, where have you been, Billy Boy, Billy Boy, oh, where have you been, Charming Billy, that comes from a Scottish ballad called Lord Randall, and he gets poisoned by some beautiful Scots lass with blue eyes and red hair. You know how it is with them. And he had too many eels as well. It sort of really run me off of eels, although, you know. Whether it's King Henry I with his surfeit of lampreys or the Lord Randall, my son, getting just a little too... No. But you know what? That's part of the reason that I don't want any genetics from any eel-like creatures going into my salmon. And why salmon? For God's sakes, why salmon? I mean, salmon's good for you. Omega-3 fatty acids and all of that stuff, right? So corporate America naturally has to F it up, right? Marketing. Rotten bastard marketers. How long until the AquaVantage salmon shows up on a plate somewhere, oh, I don't know, at McClown's or the Burger Thing? A fish and whistle with every kid's meal with the AquaVantage salmon burger. Oh, I want to stop. Oh, Mommy, Daddy, we have to stop. Oh, Jesus. You know how it goes, and it's all marketing. All marketing.
By the way, if anyone here is in advertising or marketing, kill yourself. Thank you. Just a little thought. I'm just trying to plant seeds. maybe. Maybe one day they'll take root. I don't know. You try. You do what you can. Kill yourself. Seriously, though, if you are, do. Not really. There's no rationalization for what you do, and you are Satan's little helpers. Okay? Kill yourself. Seriously. You're the ruiner of all things good. Seriously. No, this is not a joke. It's going to be a joke coming. There's no fucking joke coming. You are Satan's spawn, filling the world with bile and garbage. You are fucked, and you are fucking us. Kill yourself. It's the only way to save your fucking soul. Kill yourself. Plant seeds. I know all the marketing people are going, he's just doing a joke. There's no joke here whatsoever. Suck a tailpipe, fucking hang yourself, borrow a gun from a Yank friend. I don't care how you do it. Quit putting a goddamn dollar sign on every fucking thing on this planet.
God bless the prophet, Bill Hicks. Peace be upon him. Salmon? I mean, I know they were into, like, cloning sheep and... Salmon? Does that... I mean, and this has real-world implications. You know, they're doing this so the salmon will grow faster. It really will be a Franken-salmon. Or, more appropriately, maybe, you know, maybe it really is the Clemens salmon. The Roger salmon. The bottle rocket salmon. Maybe it's Jose Can Salmon. Oh, I'm on a roll. Salmon McGuire. Jesus. Who's out there getting paid to tear down the internal structure of a salmon to find the salmon growth hormone from a Chinook? You know, it's moments like this. It's moments like this that I really do have the, not that I necessarily agree with them, but I can kind of get on, I can kind of get, if not on the same page, then in the same chapter with the execrable fundamentalists. Because it does smell a little bit like playing God. You know, it was a couple of days ago, and I think it was Lottie who sent it along. I'm pretty sure it was Lottie. Sent me along the story of Stephen Hawking finally coming out, and not like that. Finally saying, listen, creation doesn't need God to get it started. The guy's brain works on such extra universal levels that he's finally reached the point where he understands that the Big Bang was spontaneously combusted. Oh, everybody's in on the game now. Yeah, yeah. There's Ron and Raleigh. I got one. Hey, Bob, we'll name it Salmon Sosa. David in Tennessee noting, of course, they're doing salmon because we done ruined all the salmon spawning areas just as the world has realized that the flesh is actually good for us. You know, as opposed to antibiotic and hormone-laden hamburger that has, you know, lain in a puddle of its own filth before the forklift came and picked it up and took it to turn into your Dinty Moore. Salmon Sosa. Jesus, that was too good. That was better than Jose Can Salmon, frankly. See how it works? It's frustrating as hell. Salmon Rushdie! Oh, John Fox! Over the fence! But here's the fun part. Even if will the fundies protest? No, they're too busy getting upset about a gay film festival in Seattle. And, of course, they're dominionists anyway, so they... Well, you know, it says there in Genesis, behold, I give you the fish of the sea. Well, he gave us the fish of the sea. We found out what made up the fish of the sea, and we have the technology. We can make it stronger, bigger, faster. Oh, God, if it talks like Lee Majors, we're screwed. We're screwed anyway. But don't worry, this is all going to take place in secret because you, dear consumer, you have nothing to worry about. Is this what the Obama administration meant when they said that that they were going to be guided by science? Oh. Guided by science. Yeah, well, that kind of means we got to run this. Wow, do I feel a parody coming on. I've already got an ocean reference. John, this ought to be easy. She guided me with science! Is that what this talking salmon's going to sound like? God for the music of the 80s. Where would we be without it? Yeah, that's the FDA theme song. They guided me with science behind closed doors. But enough already. Let's go to the phones and see what's shaking. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Brother Rob.
Hey, what's up, Cossack?
Not much. Yourself?
Well, you know, I don't know. It certainly looks like things tonight are a little bit fishy.
Yes. Oh, God. I wonder when these people will be happy. You know, I'm really not thrilled with the idea of experimenting on my food supply.
It just doesn't seem like a good idea, does it?
No. It's kind of like throwing a spanner in the works.
And, of course, I hear that, you know, fruit of the sea, and immediately I'm reminded of this little moment. You might recognize it.
Fish and plankton and sea greens and protein from the sea. Fish and plankton and sea greens and protein from the sea. Fish and plankton and sea greens and protein from the sea. Fish and plankton and sea greens and protein from the sea.
Yeah, you remember the robot? Fish, remember the robot that was made out of Reynolds Wrap there in Logan's Run? He was in charge of the big chest freezer.
Yep.
Somehow I've got this mental image of him being the awkward vantage scientist who will be testifying in front of the FDA behind closed doors.
I could see that, unfortunately. I don't know. Yeah, it's depressing. Did you happen to catch Democracy Now! Today?
I didn't catch it, but I know. Michael Moore?
No, I was thinking of Robert Scheer and Elizabeth Warren.
Oh, okay. I saw mention of a Michael Moore appearance. No.
Yeah. But like I said, the part about the interview with Robert Scheer is really quite good. He is basically not a very happy camper with Obama for basically becoming the Clinton second administrator for all intents and purposes. And the fact that it's basically in large part due to Clinton that the economy crashed because he listened to some Wall Street idiots. Yeah. And Elizabeth Warren, God, what a brilliant, just absolutely brilliant woman. You know, it's always a pleasure to hear her talk.
Well, you know, I did read something, Cossack, that said that her classes that had been scheduled for, like, next term or next semester or whatever, that they've been moved. And she's not teaching them.
Let us hope.
That could be a good sign.
Yeah. That's the one ray of hope in the entire industry-written bank regulation bill. And the problem of it is that Obama's getting a lot of feedback from inside the White House, from people like Rahm Emanuel and Larry Summers and Robert Rubin.
And on and on.
The same people who got us where we are to begin with. I just do not understand the thought processes of the Obama administration for putting the very people who were responsible for creating the disaster in charge of mitigating it. They did that with Wall Street. They did that with BP. You know, I don't know if I'm with somebody and they're driving a car and drive it into a ditch, I'm not going to jump back in the car with the guy who just drove the car into the ditch. Simple logic would dictate.
Sure.
Yeah. And yet, what do we do? Yeah, you know, we put the banksters in charge of cleaning up Wall Street. We put the pharmaceuticals and the medical industry in charge of writing the health bill. We put Wall Street in charge of writing the bank regulation bill. What the? You see why I'm more than a bit stymied. Is this change we can believe?
I know. I'm sort of flummoxed still from yesterday. The big speech. You know, I'd like to believe there's going to be $50 billion for much-needed infrastructure repairs. Frankly, it needs to be $100 billion. Maybe it needs to be $150 billion. Maybe it needs to be $200 billion. How interesting that when you consider numbers like that, Cossack, and you compare them with, say, the amount of money that we literally threw down the toilet, peed all over, and then flushed away in Iraq.
Yeah.
The Republican Party, and then again, this is messaging, this is framing. The Republican Party does not believe that the United States is worth the same amount of debt that we threw down the toilet in Iraq.
Oh, of course.
How hard? Why is that message so hard? Why is this so hard for the White House?
I don't know. If I didn't know better, I would think that many of the so-called Democrats that are in charge of the party have lost their minds, I think.
Oh, no, I think they just found their wallets.
Well, then, you know, same thing.
Because, you know, these are not the actions of someone who is not home. These are the actions of somebody who has just figured out where their bread is buttered.
It's, those actions are illegal. And if they aren't, they should be. I mean, it's getting ridiculous, Bob. These people are basically advertising, hi, I'm the senator from, what, yeah, which bank, which
right.
interest. You know, this is as bad as it was in the late 1800s, when they were sitting there and passing out credit mobilier bonds on the floor of the Senate. You know, when they were talking about openly in the newspapers, they were talking about the senator from United Steel. And they meant it. I mean, how long is it going to take people?
Well, wasn't it the senator from Michigan who was referred to as the senator from General Motors?
Yeah.
Back in the day?
Yeah.
So we do know that this isn't exactly new. It's just, what, new to us?
I'm just not sure people had it slapped across their face this obviously before. I mean, during the entire healthcare banking debate, you saw this come up time and time and time again, that certain senators were, whatever they were saying was not the preference of their constituency, of their voting public, you know. And every single time they landed on the side of Big Pharma or the doctor's lobby or, you know, the insurance lobby. But it was never to aid the common citizen. Freaking ridiculous. And
me, I think it goes past ridiculous.
Oh.
Some, what's that old phrase? Some might call it treason.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, have people forgotten what Kennedy said yay many years ago? If you choke off all avenues of civilized protest, you make violent revolution inevitable.
Yeah, very much
so. Ding dong. Are you people listening to yourselves? You know, pay a little bit of attention. Bob, it absolutely stonkers me that my generation of publicly educated numbskulls were so far superior to today's publicly indoctrinated kids. We don't educate anymore, Bob. We do not. We teach to the test. We teach our kids to obey. That is the prime function.
And sadly, that's also a regressive function, Cossack, because that was the origin of the idea of public education, was to give the proletariat enough of an education to make them controllable. And, you know, there you have it.
Well, to make sure they could read the instructions and follow them to some degree. It was all to create a better class of worker.
Right, exactly. And it's only through some enlightened change in the educational process that we got away from that. But as I said, what we're experiencing is a sort of regressive deflation of educational theory. I mean, I know this firsthand because my son is a ninth grader right now, Cossack, and my daughter is a junior, 11th grader. And you want to hear something fun? You want to hear something absolutely mind-boggling? Guess what? They've both been compelled to decide, each of them, in their ninth grade year. Ninth grade, Cossack. They've been asked to decide what they're going to do with the rest of their lives. You know, I only figured out what I was going to do with the rest of mine at the age of 41. That's why I'm here behind this microphone. But, you know, by God, if the thing is, if you deviate from that, if you change from that, your whole high school transcript, it just becomes an instantaneous train wreck.
Exactly. And who can, in all honesty, though you, at 14 or 15, you think you know everything, you and I know from the road we've traveled that is a bad mistake.
Oh, to say the very least. To say the very least. But it's worth bearing in mind that, you know, what I saw another thing, or heard rather, Agnes and I were out and about earlier today. You know, just take her out to get a little sunshine, a little windshield therapy, as the boys under the bridge call it. And we were listening to National Petroleum Radio on the way, and we heard some report on jobs. And I don't remember the specific reason for talking to this person, but they were talking with an executive from Manpower. Now, I think you probably know what Manpower is. They're a temp agency.
Yeah.
About what we can expect in the way of employment, rebounding or hitting the upswing or whatever, and the person was, well, you know, if and a bunch of weasel words. But as usual, it was not the content, but the circumstance that sort of grabbed me. And that, Cossack, was the fact that they had gone to a rep from a temp agency to talk about rebounding employment in the United States. And that's where we're headed.
Yeah.
You know, Sandra talks from time to time about creating the acceptance of a permanent underclass of 20% unemployment.
Right.
Because the jobs aren't there and they're not coming back. And when I heard that a temp agency executive was being asked about employment, little bells and whistles started going off inside my head, going, they're describing, nobody's going to have a full-time job in the future.
Of course not.
Nobody is going to be a whatever. There won't be any widget press operators who do that for 30 years, and or at least, you know, in the grand scheme of the Republican plan. For Merca, nobody has a pension, nobody has health care, and nobody has a steady job. We live in a constant state of desperation going from one thing to the next.
Exactly. Well, and that's the way they want to do it. You know, it's not the way that
it's the Republican conservative cheap labor, you know, son of a bitch, wet dream.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. I mean, God, I'm not sure. I think it could have been Greenspan said when he was still head of the Federal Reserve. He said that the whole reason I'm here is to keep the workforce nervous. Huh? Say what?
Well, you know, that'll go over great with Tina Berry up in New York at the Mott's company, who's highly upset because, you know, we have wage disparity here. We have too many people making $19 an hour. $19 an hour? I'm still not over or okay with that story. Meanwhile, I just got an email in Cossack from Ron in Raleigh saying, hey, Bob, did you hear about the general strike in France today? The workers are protesting Sarkozy's plan to raise the retirement age to 62. Imagine the American people hitting the streets to protest an increase in the retirement age to 70.
No.
No. No. It's worth remembering that you know, we don't... There are pockets of enlightenment in this world, if not in this country.
Yeah. There are pockets in this country, but they're shrinking. And many of the better minds are leaving for greener pastures.
Hear, hear. Cossack, I got to roll on. Hope you're feeling okay.
Pushing along.
I know. Set them up and knock them down, brother.
Will do. Take care.
All right. You too.
Say hi to Agnes.
I sure will.
All right.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Calling from North Florida, that's the Cossack. We roll onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, howdy, Bob. This is David out in San Francisco.
Well, hey, David. How are you?
Hey, pretty good. You know, I wish I could have caught Cossack on the air there a second. I heard him mention a little bit ago, he was talking about some Depression-era bonds. I had never heard that expression. Do you remember what he was talking about?
I'm not exactly sure what the context was, but I'll watch the chat room, and I'm sure he'll clue us in.
All right, good, because I'm a real history nut, and there are, you know, economics and history, and so I had never heard of a bond issue specifically with that name, so I tape recorded it, but I'll have to rewind it to catch up on it. Hey, well, you're familiar with the Carlyle Group, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Sure, and just for any of the listeners that aren't familiar with them, when anthrax first hit the stage, I guess that was about a month after 9/11, the anthrax remedy was right there ready to be sold to America. You know, if these godless Bin Laden types were going to attack America with anthrax, well, by God, the free market was out there to sell us the anthrax remedy. Well, it turned out it was owned by the Carlyle Group, and the Carlyle Group was Bush and Bush's daddy, essentially, and a whole bunch of the neocons were all heavily invested in the Carlyle Group. Well, it also turned out that the Bin Laden family was invested in the Carlyle Group, and oops, we didn't want that knowledge known, so they had to kind of shove the Bin Laden family out, but they essentially, as far as anybody can tell, they just kind of shifted pockets and allowed them to invest in other stuff. But the Carlyle method is what I'm interested in, and it kind of explains what you were just talking about. If you look at the Carlyle's website, Carlyle Group's website, it talks about how they buy up companies that are in distress. And they go around and they look for companies that are weak in the stock market. They'll go up and buy their shares for, as little as they can get them. Then they'll carve up the companies and create a new empire based upon all of these companies that they buy up cheap. And it's to their advantage for the country to go, the country as a whole to go into a tailspin, because it creates all of these stock market shutters, rises and falls, so that they can buy up these companies cheap, and then during the highs they can sell them off for a pretty penny and then buy up the other companies in distress. So it's essentially the Carlyle method that explains why the country is in the shape it is. And it also explains why Bush never really wanted to make the country's economy strong, because it was to his advantage to have his dad buy up the country at pennies on the dollar.
Well, and that's so important, David, to bear in mind, because whenever you're talking about a Bush, and we're talking about this is conduct that has gone on for generations, the Bushes are always out to see what they can siphon or suck out of the United States of America. There's not 10 cents worth of patriotism in the entire Bush family. They are and have been welfare queens on the military industrial tit for 100 years.
Yeah, that goes back to old Sam Bush. In fact, do they go even back to the Civil War? I know they go back to World War I, when Sam Bush, who was a great-grandfather, the father of Prescott, Sam Bush, was on the
War Materiels Board.
Yeah, and so he was out there buying material for the World War One, and you saw that war just drag on and on and on and on and on and never get won. The more you study about World War One, these guys sat in the same trench for years and never gained 20 yards. They just sat there and lobbed shells at each other and poison gas and all this stuff and just died in the fields like that by the tens of thousands. And who was there to scoop up all the money but old, you know, great-grandpa?
Yeah, lo and behold.
Yeah, so the Carlisle method is, you know, whether it's the Carlisle group of today or the various companies of the past, it's kind of interesting. I don't know if you're a Civil War buff, but the...
I am.
Yeah, have you ever seen either of the books about the death of Lincoln? One's called The Lincoln Conspiracy, a newer book that came out in the 1970s. But also a guy named Otto Eisenschimmel wrote a book, Why Was Lincoln Assassinated? And in both of them, both of them make the same allegation that Secretary of War Stanton, who was the Northern Secretary of War,
right,
was actually a double crosser, a double dealer. He had three different plays going. He was a profiteer, so he didn't want the war to end because, you know, there's the blank check to cash in on forever. But he also was part of what were called the Radical Republicans. And the Republican Party was a new party at the time, and they really had no opportunity to expand because their very first president was Abraham Lincoln, and he had gotten America into a huge war, and so it wasn't likely that the Republican Party was going to be able to get too much success out of it. So it was pretty much get what you can while you're in office, and then you know, you'll have to fight for it later. Well, in the case of the Radical Republicans, what they believed was if they could take away the voting rights of the South, if they could drag the war on long enough, then the people of the North would be glad to take away the voting rights away from the South. And then only half of America could vote at that point. And since the Republican Party were much stronger in the North, then essentially the Republican Party would essentially become the major party in American life.
You know, it's funny, a few years back talking about creating a permanent Republican majority. Remember that?
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And whether you do it with fake voting machines, whether you do it by putting so many people in prison that nobody can vote anymore, you make people homeless so that they can't vote, you disinspire them, you get them hooked on drugs, you figure out ways to get them so uninspired that they never show up to vote, those are just some of the average techniques that they use, much less the more strident ones like voting machines that not only don't work but that flip the count. And I don't know if you have kept up. Apparently over in Memphis, in the primary just less than a month ago, they had a major vote flip, which has essentially confounded the whole election, specifically in Memphis. And they're torn up about it because they, as I haven't read the news today, but if I understand right, they still have not certified the vote in Memphis because they have to decide whether or not they're going to actually have to redo the entire vote. And if I remember right, they were on Diebold machines. But anyway, the principle that I was looking at with your previous caller there, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats, especially the Blue Dogs and whatnot, are essentially trained in a very bad way. And many of them, if they actually believe what they're saying, and I don't really see that many of them do. I think that many of them are actually quite stupid, and they follow orders or they dance to the tune of the last person they talk to, and they really don't have any allegiance to many people. But and so economic education is totally important in all of that. But the other angle, and you were talking about this earlier as you were talking about hazardous wastes, and you were just talking about the total idea of America. You know, the policy makers, how can they be so stupid as to just move forward in these totally asinine ways? And it has to do, for many years, about a dozen years, I traveled around the country gathering data for a legal research firm. They were trying to figure out how to do lawsuits in the best way. So you had to check county by county, you know, get a random sampling. And there's what's called in torts, you typically, if somebody gets hurt, say, like, if we gave an example of the Gulf of Mexico down there, if somebody gets a case of cancer and they file a lawsuit and they got all their ducks in order, it's to the advantage of the guilty party to let them die.
Yes, absolutely. A dead plaintiff is always better than a live one.
Absolutely. They'll get 10%. By average, they'll get 10% of what they would get if they were living. And so to let them die is to the advantage. Now, if you look at most of the major politicians, you look at, say, Obama, or maybe even most of the senators or the people that he's got in cabinet positions, they know that. And even if Bush, allowed the ruination of Louisiana through Katrina, and all of the lawsuits that are piling up just based on Katrina, and not necessarily even on BP, even though they were Bush's fault, the U.S. government, it's still money that has to come out of the U.S. Treasury. So if they can drag on those cases just to make the books balance, by paying out settlements early, they're going to do more justice in America. They're going to, you know, make people happy and sound again, but they're still going to break the budget of the U.S. government, so to speak. And so if they drag it on 1 year, they drag it on 3 years, de facto, they're going to end up killing those people who are waiting for their lawsuits to come.
Look at, and you know what, the classic case in point, David, is the Exxon Valdez. It took 20 years for the punitive damages aspect of that case to wend its way all the way to the Supreme Court, wherein the rats, Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Scalia, maybe Rehnquist was still in there, but Roberts, Rehnquist, it still spells rats.
Sure, yeah.
Where they promptly said, oh, no, well, this is no good. This verdict will never stand. Why, this is a punishment to the company, as if those geniuses on the Supreme Court, David, didn't know that punitive damages are meant to punish.
Right, right. Well, and that's the whole point. They, you know, these guys are so invested, and it also gets into another thing. I've been involved in politics since I was a little kid, and, you know, quite often the way that bribes work is that someone will give a bunch of shares to one of the relatives or one of the, you know, Lyndon Johnson. There are cases where Lyndon Johnson's brother or Richard Nixon's brother would get shares in a company. The bribe would ostensibly be going toward Nixon or Johnson, but the brothers would get the shares. Or in the case of Lady Bird Johnson, they'd get this ton of advertising on their radio station that wouldn't make any sense to a cowpoke station, but somebody would buy, you know, $500,000 worth of ads for a farm station. And it wouldn't even make sense that the station would be so prosperous, but when you look at it as a lateral bribe. Well, in this case, if BP is handing out shares, they're not handing out cash as a bribe, they're handing out shares. So anybody that's holding those shares doesn't want the share price to fall. And so if they hand them out to the daughters of senators or to the sons of, the secretaries of, you know, the various cabinet posts or something like that, they still don't want the share price to fall. So, you know, obviously the smart thing for America to do would be seize the assets of BP, but to try to actually get anybody to induce the share price to fall would be, you know, it cuts the throat of both the crooked Democrats or crooked Republicans. And it's a shame. And, you know, out here in San Francisco, as a matter of fact, if you got an email, I'll send you a copy of, we've created some alternative money based upon Howard Zinn.
Yes.
And they're called Zinnias. And I'll send you some copies of them. You can print them up yourself. And they're essentially based on hours instead of a valuation of currency. So, you know, a one zinnia is worth 1 hour, a two is worth 2 hours, a five is worth 5 hours. You barter your time as opposed to bartering some currency that can be stolen away. So Howard Zinn and Ralph Nader and many other people have talked for years about, you create a currency that reflects a local control It can't be stolen away to Paris or London or Switzerland. It can only be used locally. And in this case, these zinnias, they're based upon ours. And
you know, that's kind of where I was, although you sort of led me to it, David, that's where I was headed when I was talking about the fact that NPR contacted somebody from a temp agency to talk about employment in the United States.
Right.
What we have is not a direct devaluation of the currency, and certainly not a direct devaluation of Wall Street. Instead, what we're seeing is a devaluation of the value of labor.
Or our reputations, sure. And that's what's even sicker about it, because the currency is supposed to reflect the American reputation, the wisdom of all of our school systems, the education of all of our people in total. The idea that the U.S. dollar is supposed to reflect the honesty of the American working force, or the honesty of the patriotic American, but then all of a sudden all of that money can be taken over by, you know, name the subprime scoundrels, or the savings and loans crooks, or the, you know, look at Halliburton, who once they get busted, or Blackwater, they still keep the top secret contracts, but they move offshore and they go to move to Dubai as their corporate headquarters. There isn't a common sense bit of, I mean, who in American history would ever believe that an overseas country, a company, should have a top secret contract with America? That America should not be handing out contracts to people that don't have any loyalty to America. So, you know, how is it that we keep handing out money to Blackwater when they want to move to Dubai, or Halliburton when they move to Dubai, or Bechtel when they go to, down in Jamaica or whatever?
No, the Caymans.
Yeah, Cayman Islands. I mean, if they aren't going to have any loyalty to America, you don't give them any top secret contracts. That's just name of the game. Much less to even give a basic contract, fixing a bridge or fixing the levees or anything like that. I mean, if you look at just your average, when I took economics and financial management back in the 80s, it was a real standard for a city or a town or a county. If you were going to fix a bridge, the contractor had to have a performance bond. They had to have the total value of insurance for the entire amount of that project in some kind of an intermediary account, so that the county could seize their assets if they screwed up. Well, that's not even a standard anymore. You look at BP when they're given the rights to go out and drill in our pool of oil. You know, America owns that oil underneath the Gulf of Mexico. We give them the right to dip a straw into it, and that straw has to be, if I understand right, that drilling hole has to be 18 inches in diameter, no more, no less, 18 inches in diameter. And then they're going to draw out that oil at a rate that can be measured, and that they have to have a performance bond ahead of time. Well, they didn't give them a performance bond, and when you start looking at the structure of when they, I don't know if you kept up on the details of that drilling of it, but they were supposed to have these arms on it, control arms. They were supposed to have 21 control arms on that drill bit. And if you can imagine a 3 mile long drill bit, and you're supposed to have these arms holding it in place so it's not going to wobble around. Well, if it has any wobble to it, it's not going to have an 18-inch diameter. It might be a 3-foot diameter. You know, a millimeter at the top could turn into a foot at the bottom, and or 10 feet at the bottom, based upon how much slop it is in it. So they were supposed to have 21 control rods or control arms in there, and they only had 6. So that hole may be much wider than a foot and a half in diameter. And that's why they're having so much problem with it, is because it's probably egg-shaped in the center, and so it's become an enormous cave in there as opposed to a straight chute. And if you're going to be filling it in with mud, you can do a measurement on a straight chute, but when you got a wobbly big old corkscrew cave in there, you don't know how big it is in there. So how much mud are you going to stuff into an endless hole. Anyway, not to get sidetracked with that, the performance bonds is what I was leaning on. And, you know, the government, when we have these politicians coming before us before Election Day, we should be leaning on these things. Where's the performance bond for any company that's going to come into your state? You know, your case, it's West Virginia. You've got, Georgia and, you know, Tennessee and maybe some of Virginia listening to us. You know, ask these politicians about performance bonds. If these companies that want to come into our town and set up shop don't give us a performance bond, we don't give them a license to do business.
Well, see, we've got another little bond problem here, David. And that, you know, there's a bond that has to be filed every time they decide to blow up a mountain and bury a few miles of streams.
Right, right.
And that, and it's a performance bond of a sort. That bonds the company against the fact that they might, you know, run out and leave a terrible mess. So what they do is they create the terrible mess, and then after they've created the terrible mess, they look at the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection, which is a wholly corrupt, wholly owned subsidiary of the coal industry in the first place, and say, and they point at their filthy mess that's leaching toxins and killing people, and they say, see, we made it all better. And the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection says, by Jove, you have. And the coal company says, can we be released from our bond now? And the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection says, would yesterday be okay?
Right, right. Well, are those your environmental board, are they elected or are they appointed?
Oh, no, they're appointed. They're strictly bureaucrats.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because, you know, there are a whole lot of different ways of dealing with it, and everybody, you know, I've lived in small towns where everybody's afraid of facing some of these things, but, you know, every once in a while you'll get somebody courageous and figure out a clever way of doing things. I remember when I was in Missouri, when they were trying to come up with a pollution, a waiver for pollution, water pollution for a chemical company, I didn't actually fill up their water pitcher, but you know, on the dais, the board, the city manager and the board had a water pitcher, you know, to share water, drinking water for the board, and so I raised the issue just as an allusion. Well, you know, do you know if I came and filled up that pitcher of water with what's being spilled out down there? And nobody drank from that pitcher from the rest of the evening. So, you know, it's one of those things where you got to hit them where it hurts, but at the same time, you know, get in touch with their kids. You know, if their kids can't even respect them anymore, there are a lot of lateral ways of you know, convincing these people that not only are they saboteurs to the state, but that you know, fill up their dog's water with the water that's coming out of those creeks. There's a whole lot of different ways of you know, getting somebody where it hurts. There's you know, saboteurs are saboteurs, and somebody that when they take office, they typically pledge that they're going to, you know, they swear them in, right? And when they don't swear, you know, when they lie, when they swear, they're yeah, you know where we're going with that. So
yep.
Anyway, I just that whole Carlisle method thing. You know, these people, they're invested in the downfall of America, and we have to find ways. Like I was saying with the Zinnia, we have to invest in our time as opposed to investing in their funny money. And there's always a way. You know, Howard Zinn, these Zinnia alternative currencies are based upon the historical fact that, you know, the money has gone sour hundreds of times in American history. There were, in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, between, what, 1864 or something like that, and 1929, there were probably 30 different panics. And some of them were regional, some of them were nationwide. You know, they were very common for the America to get scammed, but the fact is that ever since Ronald Reagan changed the interstate banking laws, he's made it easier for the money to leave America instantly. And it was bad enough in a panic that somebody could take a trunk of money across the state lines, and then you had to have the attorney general sue to get it back. But now it's electronically transferred overnight or in an instant, and it becomes more difficult to find out where that money ended up once it gets divvied up electronically. So, you know, to create our own money, we have to find ways that that all of a sudden their money becomes worthless because we can actually do better with our own kind of money. And creating a value out of your time is something that you can control. Creating value out of their funny money is something you can't control. Find ways of, I don't know if you've got time to talk about the economics of coal, but I mean, basically, the average taxpayer is paying about 30 cents per kilowatt hour in their taxes, in their April 15th taxes. And on their bill, they're looking like they're paying 15 cents a kilowatt hour, but they're really paying a total of 45 cents a kilowatt hour in subsidies to the coal industry. And so, since right now it's costing about 17 cents a kilowatt hour to produce electricity through solar, we could save 30 cents by just going over to solar, and the coal boys would be broke in overnight. They'd be back to buggy whips, an economy of buggy whips, or blacksmiths or whatever. You know, we could make them broke overnight by going to solar. And, you know, all you have to...
Oh, they know that.
Right. They don't want that subsidy sugar tit to end. And, you know, I spend quite a bit of time, you know, talking about the economics of coal. They're still trying to push that so-called clean coal. And, you know, I call around, and many of the neocons, boy, they'll try to sidetrack the discussion right away when you start talking about how much your April 15th money is being spent on coal. But,
The shortcut on clean coal, David, is always quite easy. Clean coal is a dirty lie.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, absolutely. Hey, well, thanks, Bob. I'll give a holler a little more often.
Oh, I hope you will. I really hope you will, David. It's good to hear from you.
Yeah, and by the way, I was at your website just a second ago. I didn't see any response from your previous caller. Did he have any word on what those bonds meant?
I've been watching. I haven't seen, but I can't watch all the time. Cossack, shoot me an email, and when he does, I'll make sure an announcement.
Hey, sure, appreciate it.
All right, take care, David. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, good.
Bye now. Another of the Davids. This David being out in the San Francisco Bay Area, I do believe. We will roll onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
If you say David three times, they appear like the Candyman.
Yeah, no
that's
kidding.
The second one, then if the next one comes, then that's beyond spooky. Hold on to your Ouija boards, people. I mean,
okay. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I was listening to I've been looking at some of the results of Obama's speech and how people are gauging it, and it always comes back to this. The Obama supporters, they always come back to what Obama promised and what is coming for us. And it all comes down to this, Bob. These promises, and you know this, but a lot of these Obama supporters who are young and naive, this stuff is going to be ripped to shreds, people. It literally is going to be ripped to shreds. And anything that we were looking forward to right now, you're going to see the majority be kissed away. You're going to see most of it be kissed away. You're going to still have to deal with these Republicans 24/7. And see, the problem is that we don't have this realistic approach of what we're looking at. People tell us, the political scientists, strategists, bloggers, writers, they give us this giddy picture of what we're supposed to expect. But look. When you have the media constantly on lock, it doesn't work like that. And you have a public that is not engaged. You have a public that is not active. I keep telling this to writers, Bob. You are an anomaly. You are the last unicorn of your region. So much of what we're seeing right now, and believe me, people, the Democrats are not going to come out for the midterms because that's just the way it is. Everything that we're looking at right now, you need to be honest. And we need to be honest about what's happening right now. And we need to be honest that the monopoly of the media, the control, the gridlock, and people who tell me we just need to hold on a little bit longer to Obama. It's not like praying, people. It doesn't matter if I hold on or I don't. What matters is the person who has the mouthpiece and the microphones and the antennas that are on right now. That's what matters. Not what a writer or a blogger says. Or any putting out this message of hope and change and going along with the sucker, the car in the ditch and thinking that's going to make a bit of difference. It's not going to make a bit of difference when everything's coming at you 24/7.
I understand everything you just said. And I find it a little disheartening, David.
I understand that. It's disheartening, but here's the problem with it. The problem is, and I hate to say this, writers who write in the Democratic fashion, the progressive and the liberal fashion, you need to be effing honest about what we're facing. And you can't paint these rosy pictures. Because whatever you thought was going to happen in 1980 and 1990 and in the future, we're looking at pockets of resistance right now in this country that are barely holding on. And the ones that will hold, and you have to look at it like this, there are going to be some that are just going to be gone. They're gone. They're going to be in hopeless despair. And you can't paint these rosy scenarios and these pictures of just constantly telling people, well, this is what we're going to do, and we're going to have this, and we just need to hold on to this, and if we just push a little bit harder. After a while, Bob, we have to look at the reality of what we're facing, and we have to look at, and we see what we're losing, and then we have to put the discipline in action, Bob. That's the thing that people need to understand. We have to put a discipline in action. We have to have organized roles, and if we have to do that by force, Bob, we have to do it by force. I don't know what to tell people. Get your kids involved, get everyone involved, and we need to list out roles just like other political parties have done, and you know that's part of the problem. People don't understand.
But I mean, but David, I don't think you can just give up and say nobody's going. You've got to. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy if you do that. People have got to be encouraged to get out and vote because, as disheartened, and I'm sorry, we live in a system where we wind up voting for the lesser of two evils. If we don't want to do that, as I've said before, we have to get serious about the nature of the primary system. Okay, and get busy in the primaries. But as it stands, there are monumental differences at stake on November 2nd, 2010. And no matter how frustrated we may be with the Democrats in Congress, take a minute and imagine a House of Representatives run by a pumpkinhead boner. If that doesn't give you the dribbling trots, nothing will. Because, see, they won't govern the way the Democrats do. They will cram things. They'll break the rules. They'll hold votes open. They'll do whatever they can to cram legislation through and then dare Barack Obama to veto it. And the question, as it has developed over the course of the last several shows, is, does Barack Obama have the stones to veto legislation?
It looks like he's going to continue on believing what his philosophy is and his worldview is, and it doesn't. And I don't think it's going to matter how many people angry, how angry they get. He's going to continue to believe that this is the right thing to do, because that's the way he sees it. You know, Bob, I'll tell you something interesting. I live right next to. We have a building. This will give you an example, people, of where we're at. This is why a lot of people need to understand. I live just a bunch of buildings right next to me, people in different apartments and all that. I live right next to City Hall. I'm probably the only person who goes and votes every year.
In that proximity. Oh yeah, look. There's a post that just showed up. And again, it's one of those moments where I hear the music between the notes instead of the notes themselves.
Right.
There's a post that just went up at Think Progress. I go there quite frequently, despite the BP ads that run there. But the headline on this post says, nearly half the public is very uncomfortable with phasing out Social Security for private accounts. Let me just say that again, David.
Yeah.
Nearly half the public, is very uncomfortable with phasing out Social Security for private accounts. Now, this has to do with a poll by the Wall Street Journal and NBC News, and it's one of those sort of scattershot, shotgun blast polls where they ask people about a lot of different stuff. And that slayed me when I read the headline. Of the people who responded to this poll, not quite. And see, this is headline writing 101. It's not nearly half the public. It's, holy cow, less than half the public is very uncomfortable with it. Because, let's put it this way. I had a buddy once who said, you know, I saw that statistic where 48% of automobile fatalities are caused by drunk drivers.
Yeah.
And he said, you know what that makes me think? You know what that tells me, Bob? And I said, what? And he said, it tells me that 52% of the fatalities are caused by sober people.
Yeah.
Well, this is that, David. Holy cow! Less than half of the American people are given the dribble and trots by the idea of privatizing Social Security. What happened to the third rail, David?
Yeah, but see,
51% of the American people are pretty much okay with it.
You know, Bob, there's going to be a time where people will pay to go to work.
It's not there will be a time. That time is now. Wasn't it you that brought up the story about the people who are paying to be allowed to blog for corporate America?
Yeah.
That was you, wasn't it?
No, I actually talked about the Philadelphia and they had to license.
No, this was a little further back, or maybe it's a story I saw. But, yeah, people, and they're not being paid in real money. They're being paid by in online credits that they can use in Farmville. Woo!
But see, that's the thing about it is that I don't want to give the impression that that I think that voting is hopeless and all of that. And that's not my impression. It's the flock mentality. And the reality is, people, and I'm sorry, but this is the reality, is that this flock mentality, they switch on you in a heartbeat. And that's pretty much, Bob, why a progressive movement and a liberal movement and all of that is not likely, because of the fact of we don't have control of the media. We don't have a message pumping out 24/7 at a relentless pace that we have now. And you know, everywhere I see, and a lot of people who talk about politics, they talk about the same three or four issues that aren't really important. They go back to my theory about what I was talking about, the distractocracy. And I stop them and I say, why do you care about this shit? I mean, let's look at this whole thing with the burning of the Quran, right? Why is it that on CNN, MSNBC, all these channels, they bring this guy on, or they bring a representative on, or his lawyer, or whatever, and they say, please don't do this. Please don't do this. They give that thing, but then they say, when are you going to do it again? On 9/11, you're going to burn a Quran? Oh, no, that's not good. And then Petraeus comes out and says, you know what, you shouldn't burn a Quran. It's like they're hyping it up for this.
Yeah, thing. Apparently it wasn't true that the guy had been busted for kiddie porn, but it's not for want of me rooting for it. I haven't seen any more about that. God, I wish it was. But, you know, I've been thinking about it, and this is going to damage my credibility.
Right.
But, you know, we'll give it a little dinger just because we know where this is coming from inside my psyche. Yeah. You know what the remedy to burn a Quran day is?
What's that?
Wherever this clown is burning Qurans, you set up across the street from him and you start burning Bibles. And you start burning the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah.
And you start burning the Upanishads and the Torah. You burn it all. And you know what? Everybody will be freaking. Every religious, the Jain holy sect, up in smoke.
You know what's going to
happen? You play John Lennon's Imagine the whole time you're doing it. And you know what's funny? The Baptists will have a fit. The Catholics will have a fit. The Lutherans will have a fit. The Hindus will have a fit. The Jews will have a fit. The Muslims are already having a fit. the fundies across the street burning the Quran will have a fit. God bless them. The only ones who won't will be the Zen Buddhists saying, you need a match, kill the Buddha.
I think the problem with that, Bob, is that if we were to even go down that road and just burn all bunch of holy sacraments and books, I think the problem that we'd face is it would be like that opening scene from 2001 with the Discord Ligeti score, those rising voices, and you see the people hitting each other with the caveman with the bone.
Oh, it would be, but you know what? Maybe once and for all, we'd figure out how toxic all of it is.
Oh, man. You know, I'm with you on it, but here's the problem. Who's going to be the one who burns it? Who's the one who has the courage to actually do that all at once? Because the media would be so much on your ass, and I mean, you're looking at people who have families who would be embarrassed and shamed to be. It would take a lot of courage to do that.
You know, it reminds me of J.C. Christian Patriot is, right?
Oh yeah.
Jesus is general.
Yeah, Jesus general. Yeah.
You know, he's having a burn the Confederate flag, or maybe he's already had it. He'd be just the guy.
He's a start. Yeah. He's a start. Now you got to find.
Or maybe you just do it. Maybe you just do it on your own time, and you have to be like a Palestinian and pull the ski mask over your head. But you shoot the video of you burning a Bible.
You know what?
You burning a Bhagavad Gita, and you burning burn them all. And put it up on YouTube and say, "Nah, take that."
It's definitely something to think about.
Well, I realize that I'm not being helpful right now, but and this is strictly a function of my own frustration, because I don't believe in burning books.
I'm
kind of where Thomas Jefferson was. If you strip away all the hullabaloo and the hoodoo and the smoke and the mirrors and the snake oil and get away from all the miracles and the magic, there's actually some wisdom to be had in the books. There's good ideas to be had in the books. If you read it, and you see, that's the thing. What makes them, no book is ever dangerous by itself.
Right.
A book becomes dangerous only when an unenlightened mind gets its neurons on it. Because the next thing you know, you're reading Leviticus and going, well, I can't eat any shellfish, but damn, I like the shrimp. But over here it says, kill the queers! That's the part I like. And in the Quran, you know, it says there can be no compulsion in religion, and there's all this peace and love in it. But, you know, one ass hat finds a verse, oh, kill the infidel. That's the part I believe in.
Oh, by the way, before I go, did you see that story on the Republican operative putting in the Green Party candidates in Arizona?
Oh, I read about it.
But did you see the pictures of the candidates? I mean,
no.
Holy shit! I mean, it's just so bad. One guy looked like they got him off the street off the Bum Fights DVD, and they put him in a white shirt and said, "Here, stand for a photo op." And then the other kid, holy crap! The other kid, he looks like he's just looking right in the camera, like an emo 20-year-old kid, and he's like, "Oh my God, I hope I don't get caught." It just stand. Oh, and the craziest thing is they have the same exact shirts on. I'm like, holy shit. How much more transparent can you get? Probably not as transparent as a salmon.
Yeah, it's Jesus. Nice job looping it back, David.
Yeah.
You know, and we thought it was cool in the Star Trek movie when Mr. Scott came back and made transparent aluminum, but man, they're light years ahead. We're working on transparent fish.
Oh, but speaking of sci-fi, I wanted to bring this to your attention because I know you're a sci-fi fan and you will be happy to hear this. But Tom Lennon from Reno 911, Sergeant Dangle.
Yes.
He's putting together a pilot of people in space, and it's called something like USS Alabama.
Oh dear God, I can't wait for that.
Well, it looks like
rednecks in space. Oh dear.
Well, with him at the head of it, it should be something to be interesting to see if it takes off or not.
Well, another member of the Society of Davids, David in Tennessee, just told me, he said, I heard the NPR interview with the guy that put up the green candidates. NPR got punked again. Oh, God. David, great conversation, my friend.
All right, Bob.
All right, take care. Bye now. And, you know, the phone lines are open. We're not at our usual all stacked up if you want to get in for the last hour of the program. Remember, the program has to end on time now because even as we speak, Rick Smith is gearing up and getting ready for another night's broadcasting there in his Rick Smith Batcave studio somewhere in the wilds of central Pennsylvania among all the conservatives up there. So we got a little conversation time coming. We've also got coming, because they took last week off and went camping and backpacking and stuff like that. It had to be wonderfully good fun. Our good friends Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen, they're back with the Green News Report. That's on its way. Jump in line. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4. Head on. By the way, the voting on the essay at BourdainMediumRaw.com. Nine votes, and we are already up to number 475 out of 1,589. We're on the way, folks. I don't know how far. Gosh, it would be nice to get into number one like we did a couple of years ago with the Netroots Nation scholarship thing. Can we do it? Well, I'm not allowed to vote for it myself. Only you can. So if you want to, jump in. And, you know, if you're not in the chat room where you can go see the link, or you're not on Facebook, why not? You're not on Facebook where you can go to my Facebook page and see the link. You can always go to BourdainMediumRaw.com and just type in where it says search. It says find an entry. Type in monolith. I think I'm like the second entry there. It's called Dancing Around the Monolith with a Spoon. Go and vote. Apparently, votes really count. I mean, if nine votes can take me from 1,582, or take us from 1,582 to 475, God only knows what could happen. Jump in there and go, oh, my God, there's another vote. We're at 10. I wonder how far that'll take it. For God's sakes, let's find out. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You're listening to The Horn.
Plankton, sea greens, and protein from the sea. Fresh as harvest day. Overwhelming, am I not? Are you too startled? Am I too removed from your ken?
What? Who are you?
I'm more than machine, oh man. More than a fusion of the two. Don't you agree? Wait for the winds. Then my birds sing, and the deep grottos whisper my name. Bogs, Bogs, Bogs.
This place is a link to sanctuary, isn't it?
Link?
How do you think we got here?
Same as the others. Don't you remember?
Why do you think we're here?
Why? Why?
We were sent here, and you know it. You say others have been sent here. Where are they? In hiding?
Hiding? Yes. Hiding.
You know about sanctuary. I know you do.
Sanctuary.
You have to help us.
Catfishes
love you.
Cowfishes
love you.
Ballfishes fish running up to in the ocean blue. Lungfish, blackfish, alligator, ice fish, orange, hammerhead, anaconda, flathead, manta ray, stingray, fangtooth, moray, gobbler shark, grass carp, brown purple bat ray, noodlefish, hagfish, manowar, ladyfish, black eel, baby seals, frat core, electric eel, lamprey, pitcher ray, yellow witching, moray, seven shark, sleepy shark, featherback, and eagle ray. Well, you can ignore this plea, that's fine with me, but one day you'll see that my words are true. You find that you agree, I guarantee that you will soon be feeling the love too. Cause swordfishes
love you,
jellyfishes
love you,
starfishes
I wanna be with you forever,
you know it's true. Catfishes love you, cuttlefishes
love you,
blowfishes
starfish love me
in the ocean blue.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Tuesday, September 7th, 2010.
I want America to have the best infrastructure in the world.
Obama calls for rebuilding America's roads, railways, and runways. BP's blowout preventer raised from the deep, and oil is found in oyster beds. A climate change skeptic reverses course, plus the Coke-tipus. Billionaires try to stop California's landmark global warming law.
All of that and more, as if that's not enough, straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
We're talking roads, we're talking bridges, we're talking dams, levees, but we're also talking a smart electric grid that can bring clean energy to new areas. We're talking about high-speed rail lines.
Wow, that's a whole lot of talking, Mr. President. Now, how about that whole action thing? Yep, we're back from vacation. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Des, welcome back to the grid.
Yes, you do.
We had a great vacation camping up there in Flaming Gorge on the edge of the canyon, right in the middle of the Uinta Mountains. It was beautiful. Saw moose, deer, bighorn sheep that had recently been reseeded into the region, peregrine falcons. It was a beautiful time.
Yes, always good to support your national park system.
Yeah, good point. National park system set up in no small part by Teddy Roosevelt, that pinko, liberal, commie, leftist,
Republican
president who understood what our national treasures were about and how they needed to be conserved for generations. Thank you, TR. What do you have for us today, Des?
Well, in the BP oil disaster in the Gulf, Labor Day marked the end of summer and the end of the lost summer tourism season on the Gulf Coast. Some Mississippi commercial fishermen report finding oil in Mississippi oyster beds just days after federal officials reopened those waters to commercial fishing. The blowout preventer, which failed to prevent the blowout of BP's oil well, has been raised from the deep and is now in the possession of the FBI. It will be taken to a NASA facility in Louisiana to be examined as forensic evidence to determine what caused the explosion on April 20th. That killed 11 men and led to the worst oil spill in U.S. history. At a Labor Day rally on Monday, in what sounded like full campaign mode, President Obama announced a plan to dedicate $50 billion to rebuild the nation's crumbling infrastructure.
Today, I am announcing a new plan for rebuilding and modernizing America's roads and rails and runways for the long term. I want America to have the best infrastructure in the world. We used to have the best infrastructure in the world. We can have it again.
The proposal would set up a U.S.-run infrastructure bank to develop projects to rebuild and expand roads, railways, and runways over the next 6 years to boost the economy by creating demand, which should create jobs. The White House said it would pay for this program by asking Congress to close tax loopholes for oil and gas companies.
Oh, that'll fly.
Oil and gas industry lobbyists have already said they will launch a counter campaign.
Well, that's some surprise. Is there any chance that this proposal has more of a chance to move forward than climate change legislation, which was just completely derailed by the Republicans?
It would seem unlikely that Republicans would want to hand Obama a legislative victory right before the November elections.
Yeah, but good talk right before the November elections, wasn't it?
Can a climate change skeptic change his spots? Well, one of the world's most prominent climate change skeptics, Bjorn Lomborg, the author of the book The Skeptical Environmentalist, has reversed course and now says climate change should be a top priority of governments. Previously, Lomborg had mocked the science behind climate change, saying money spent on humanitarian efforts like fighting global poverty should be a higher priority. But he now calls for spending billions on developing clean energy, even going so far as to call for a carbon tax.
Good for him for fessing up to being kind of wrong in the first place. That's one down, about 20 billion wingnuts to go.
The congressional midterm elections are fast approaching in November, and Proposition 23 on the November ballot in California seeks to suspend California's landmark global warming law to reduce emissions until after California's unemployment rate drops below 5.5% for a whole year. That would be effectively killing it, since that threshold's only occurred about three times in the last 30 years.
Yeah, right. It's very rarely below 5.5% for four quarters in a row, and I suspect the industry operatives who are setting this up know that damn well.
Prop 23 campaign is funded with millions from two Texas oil refinery corporations.
What? You don't say.
Yeah, they have refineries in California and want emissions laws to stay just the way they are. Economists and big technology companies in Silicon Valley say Prop 23 would gut California's booming clean energy industry and actually kill job growth. Prop 23 has attracted millions in funding from other out-of-state oil interests, too, notably the billionaire Koch brothers, that's K-O-C-H, Koch, who own another oil company that's donated $1 million to the campaign.
That original law, which Prop 23 is designed to kill, by the way, was signed into law by that other commie pinko leftist, Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Republican governor of California. Our own Ernie Canning, who kept an eye on the Brad blog while we were gone, has much more to say about the Orwellian Prop 23. Check that out at our website, greennews.bradblog.com. Back from vacation, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Bob.
9 minutes past the hour in this final hour of tonight's Tuesday evening program on the Horn. I wanted to head to a couple of emails real quick. Had a couple of them roll in from our good friend Robert over in Japan. And, you know, being on the outside looking in, he often has perspectives that you and I might not as easily come by. And the same The same is true in this instance. Backing up to yesterday evening, Robert said, greetings from Japan. I was a bit shocked to hear about the 10% drop in union membership, or perhaps I shouldn't be at all, as people are constantly getting dumbed down. The problem, as I see it, is that people nowadays do not want to stand up and fight for their own rights and living standards, especially as there are thousands of people wanting to work for much less than what they are earning. People are scared. And with the free trade gig that the U.S. and so many nations are on, it is harder and harder to jump to another job, as there are no other jobs. All the factories are in China. A second problem is that of deflation. And so this has become a huge problem here in Japan. For rent, for sale signs are everywhere. And where we had 1% cuts in our national university budgets, next year the Prime Minister has proposed 10%. The idea is that he does not want Japan to be like Greece. This all leads to lower expectations and to fear. And the fear results in less spending, as we might need it to buy food, tofu, later on next year in order to survive. The solution, of course, is to get rid of all of the free trade pacts and not to start working on building up a new generation of factories that are in the U.S. Get rid of all the free trade pacts and to start working on building up a new generation of factories that are in the U.S. But, you know, that is not going to ever happen. People nowadays want it all. See, I disagree with Robert in that regard. It will happen. The jobs will come back to the U.S. when the U.S. worker has been taught that 30 cents an hour is a damned good wage, and he ought to be grateful for it, and if he's not careful, he'll make 20 cents. That's when the jobs will come back from China. Robert says nothing's going to change unless that trade deficit is solved. Again, something I said the other night, it ain't the budget deficit, it's the trade deficit. Robert continues, I heard that most of the stimulus money went to China as the manufactured goods had to be bought from there. So the stimulus money just ends up helping communist China and not the ordinary American, or should I say most Americans. It makes my mind spin. I wonder how much worse it has to get until people see the light. Just my two bits. Robert noted last night, typhoon coming today. Actually made it up to the Sea of Japan and into my neck of the woods. Kind of amazing. Robert continues on the subject of money in the Japanese yen. The very lunacy of competing national currencies has become more apparent. No matter how efficient your country and your workers are, it can all be flushed down the toilet if the speculators bet on your currency and drive it up, making exporting manufactured goods almost impossible. Such is the case of Japan, especially now. So, in order to drive down the currency, the country has to go into debt, so the national debt of Japan is the highest in the world, almost 170% of its GNP. So, in actuality, the yen is worthless, but the yen still has its value in the international market. Even during the huge crisis of 2008, when exports dived 30%, and so the currency should have gone down 30%, but no, the brainless speculators drove up the currency to new highs. Of course, Robert says, you know that I never saw any decline in food prices or on imports. It just doesn't work that way, does it? Wow. It's emails like that that let me know that there is a concerted effort. It's not just working people in the U.S. It's working people everywhere. There is no such thing as please write this down to a right winger, to a Milton Friedmanite, to a conservatard, to a teabagger, to any of these monsters of the market. Write this down. There is no such thing as an acceptable level of wages. The constant goal of the anarcho-randians and the wild-eyed free marketeers, unbending goal. The thing that drives them day in and day out is the realization that if they just press a little harder, sooner or later, we'll all be near starving and willing to work for free. And from there we go to the point, what did David from Maine say a few minutes ago? Where we'll pay them for the job.
We've seen this before. This is nothing new.
You know, Ecclesiastes, like I said, there's some wisdom in those books once you get past the magic and foo-fraw and shenanigans and carrying on. Book of Ecclesiastes says there is nothing new under the sun. And where conservatives trying to figure out a way to make it harder for working people is concerned, that may be the single greatest truth that that book contains. 14 past the hour and we go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Hey, what's up, Gary?
Hey, what's going on? Nothing much. You had a perfect lead-in to what I was going to discuss, you know, with you.
Oh, awesome. Awesome.
Thinking. Yeah, you know, because I'm calling in because, you know, I am an Obama supporter. I'm still an avid Obama supporter. I think that what you were just saying about the white ring pressing on is exactly what my, you know, when I called him, I guess, about 2 weeks ago, and he calls a firestorm about the gift.
Yeah, well, you started a little trouble, but that's okay.
No, that's okay. That's just part of being on the line. We have different opinions. That this whole thing where we don't get everything now that we want, then we just bail out. Whereas you just said, the Republicans don't do that. They keep pressing on a little bit here, a little bit there. The fact of the matter is, the way I see it, again, my opinion, is that let's look at the reality of just the nature of everything. We have a very aging population. That's the overarching situation here. We have a large block of people, mainly white, who are older, who are, and when it comes right down to it, racist and intolerant. Fundamentalists, we know all of that. And the demographics of our country is changing to something that's a little bit more progressive. We all know that. Also know it's going to become more Hispanic. So the thing is, we have to ask ourselves the question is, if we know that those things are heading our way, and we know that what the Republicans are as a base, values don't match that new coming demographic, then we have just a little bit of time to maybe hold on to something till we can forge ahead what I believe is the new dawn. Never had no grand vision of Obama coming in and making all these changes overnight, or making as many changes as he had. And I think that what has happened with the, you know, again, this is where I was coming from last time I called in, that I understand the anger of people who want things because after Bush we were so shell-shocked. But I think we need to calm down and keep a perspective on a grander, more progressive vision. Because my problem with the progressives in general is, and I say this as a person who's actually more left than a lot of people call in, believe it or not, because I believe you should destroy the whole European capitalist system overall, but I realize you can't do that. I mean, because too many things intertwined with that. I was just going to say that that we have to look at the situation as it is, and we have to just make a contrite decision that we're going to move in this direction or that direction. We saw what happened in 2000 when some people who said, remember, they weren't happy with Gore because Gore was playing all this politics. He was acting like a Republican, doing the same thing Obama is, moving to the right, triangulating, reading polls, wasn't doing what they wanted, and then decided to go to the Green Party. And then usher in George Bush. Now, I don't have a problem with that, but here's my problem with it. I haven't seen no Green Party. I don't see any progressive. They can't take out Blanche Lincoln. They don't seem to be able to do X, Y, and Z. I don't care if it's the media. I don't hear anything about the media causing this and that or whatever.
Well, I'll be honest, Gary, with the Blanche Lincoln thing, if Barack Obama would have just sat back and let Blanche Lincoln get what she had earned in screwing him instead of injecting himself into the race, we might have a progressive candidate in that general election
now. I counter that with saying it was really Bill Clinton that pulled her hair. Remember, she was down about 7-8 points against him until Bill Clinton went in that weekend. But that being said,
but the Obama administration was not silent.
No. But I'm not talking about Obama. I'm talking about the progressives in our country and in our party being able to take that out. Because here's the problem: if the progressives have taken him out, it would send a message to the Obama administration that the progressives are in charge of this party. But we're not telling Obama right now, as far as I can see, that we're in charge of this party. You know, that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying I disagree with you What I'm saying is that right now he's doing exactly what Bill Clinton did in 1993 when he was his poll numbers down. Clinton moved straight to the center and got reelected. You know, and that's where you know.
I hate to even do this, but Gary, can I point out to you that Clinton had something going for him that Barack Obama does not, and we both know what it is.
Yeah, we know that. Yeah, he has that. Yeah, we're gonna have that.
Bill Clinton had Bill Clinton's whiteness working for him.
And he played it with the soldier, you know, he played it.
And you see that's the frenzy of a racist is unlike anything that most people in this country in this generation have ever seen. And what the thing is, and it goes back to a question that I asked a few nights ago on the program. Is it possible that the black community in the United States will be enough to carry Barack Obama? Because racism, white racism is toxic and it spreads faster than it, Jesus, it spreads faster than chicken pox in an elementary school.
It is, but you know, I think that in the end, I think there's one miscalculation that a lot of people in the media are making. The Republicans probably get the House. I think they're going to have a hard time getting the Senate because basically, from what I understand, just looking at some of the math, I think, number one, I can tell you for sure that one thing I found out a couple of months ago, and I was kind of shocked by this. I was talking to my mother, and she's involved, you know, heavily with the NAACP. They actually had been talk about having a march because they you know, the African-Americans nationwide, it's kind of under the cover like the Million Man March because of all the racism. They think that Barack Obama's being treated unfairly, and as a response also to the Tea Party movement. That's why you've seen lately the NAACP come out, you know, with this Tea Party agenda. But they decided they didn't ever formulate it. But I think what's going to happen is that you're going to have more blacks show up than normal. And matter of fact, I know that for a fact because even people in my family talking, we want to make sure everybody's voting X, Y, and Z. That's not probably going to help them so much in the congressional, but it will help with some of the Senate votes because of just, you know, being in certain areas and districts, because when they keep saying likely voter, we all know who they're talking about, you know.
Well, these are all telephone polls that don't include cell phones, so I think that
voters is older white.
They are demographically skewed in the first place.
Yeah. If they ask me a question, do I think the country's going the wrong question? I'm going to support Democrat. I would have said, yeah, I think it's going the wrong direction. So it's not going to. I mean, any dumb idiot can tell the country's going the wrong direction, but to me, it's more or less because of the things that Bush has done, and that is going to be hard for any person at this point to correct because he's setting something in motion. It's like when an avalanche starts, you know, it started. This is going to be damage, and you just have to let the damage wait itself out, and once the smoke and everything clears, dig yourself out, and the avalanche is still coming down. I mean, people are acting like it has stopped, but it's still coming down, you know. And that's what I don't think. I think Obama has failed to, you know, I know why he's doing it because you don't want to be the whiner, but, you know, there's just a domino effect that's going to happen for a number of years from now. I mean, that's just the reality of it. There's no getting out of this, you know. it just is.
Well, every storm has to be ridden out.
Exactly.
You can't go somewhere that the storm isn't, especially in American politics.
Exactly. So, you know, that's really, you know, the situation. And that's pretty much how I would see it. I would just say that, you know, people, you know, like the previous caller, who is very frustrated, well, I understand. But, I mean, we got this one. It's like I said, you know, one time we called before, you know, a caller said, this is ride or die. You know, we can jump out the car, you know, Obama keeps using this dish thing. Well, we can jump out of the car right now and have no control of slapping him back at the head, you know, and telling him, grabbing on the steering wheel for me and turning in the right direction. Or, you know, again, we can just jump out of the car and let the whole Democratic and the whole nation crash. You know, because the Republicans are not interested in people in driving this car into the ditch. They're interested in driving the car across the cliff, jumping out at the last moment with us in it. That's really the true analogy here that what's going on. You know that, Bob. You've been talking about it for a long time. And if we know that's the case, then I don't think we can be obsessed with the, you know, getting the perfect, you know, whatever they call it, the making the
letting the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Yes, we have to suck up some things and say, hey, okay, we didn't get everything we wanted, but we got to focus on getting progressive Democrats in place, just identifying them and just keep until the administration or whoever's administration, Obama, Clinton, or whoever else comes up in the future, understands that we are a progressive party. But I've been saying this last couple of years. People don't agree with me, but just being my little time with the DNC and everything else, we are not really a left party. We're a center party. There's more.
That's the same as me constantly asking, you know, what left?
Yeah, because you keep saying, like, Joe Manchin's situation, all these Democrats coming out and supporting him. I mean, they're not really progressive. I mean, that's just the reality. Now, we're probably just learning that, but they just aren't. And I'm fortunate that my congressman is a progressive, Don Edwards. But, you know, in general, a lot of them aren't. And so, you know, most of these, very, very, key districts. That being said, I don't want to hog up your time. Cause I know you got.
No, you've got a couple. You're lucky, Gary. You've got a good congresswoman, and you've got two good senators.
Exactly.
You've got Ben Cardin, and you got Barbara Mikulski.
Yeah, sometimes I have to call her and get on her about certain things. But, you know, they're pretty good, and we're pretty progressive. So I don't have that much problem, but, you know, I still try to go down to Virginia, Pennsylvania, and do whatever work I can for the Democratic Party,
I want to be clear. I'm not urging people to give up on the Democratic Party. I
think that when you start to go into a very I know what you mean. I know what you mean personally. I know where your heart is personally and what you want. But I think it can come across that the frustration level is a I give up strategy. You know, I'm just you know what I mean. It can come up that way.
It's certainly not what I intend.
I know it, but I think that you know.
but again, I do maintain the truth, and I understand what a scary, dangerous word that is. I maintain the truth of my assertion, Gary, that these guys are never going to form the parade. We're looking out of Congress and the Senate and the presidency. We're looking for something that they are apparently incapable of doing. We have to form the parade and invite them to come, to get in it and march.
I agree with you. Agree with you 100%. I'm just saying that now that we got like 7 weeks away, I would rather like okay, let's just try to hold off on X, Y, and Z, and then once we get them back, get at least hold the house for now, then we can start giving them the workover again. You know what I mean? That's all I'm saying. That's where I'm at. I mean, I don't look at it as actually voting for the lesser of the evil. I look at it more or less voting for a future of something that could be better. Even if I have to put something that I don't like right now just to maintain a structure, to put something else in better. Because if the Republican get control of the party, and then the Supreme Court, and all this at stake, man, a lot of people are going to be like, really, really hurt. And I don't want to just like get caught up on just one or two issues and say, okay, and not realize that there's a lot of issues on the table. That's what I was, going to say. Bob, I just want to make, can I make one thing and then I'll let you go?
Sure.
When I called him a couple of weeks ago, I said I was starting 5-star because, my opinion. the one thing I will say, I don't have a problem with anybody disagreeing with me. I mean, I get disagreements all the time, so I'm used to that. But I do think it would probably be better in some, it's your show, you regulate it how you want. It's not for me to say what people should say. But I don't think it's really good for a caller to repeatedly mention my name or pound my name in a diatribe for 20, 30 minutes. Normally, what as a professional left caller, I consider myself, normally most people just say the previous caller. I don't even mind if the person says my name one time.
Well, I guess that happens here because there's more of a family aspect to it, and so even when we squabble like a family. But I understand. Yeah, but I do understand what you're saying.
No. But the problem is, I don't actually have a problem with the person using my name. The problem is the person restates something I said and it makes it totally incorrect what I say. So then I would rather that person just say previous caller because if he can't comprehend what I'm saying, or if he's just going to misstate what I'm saying, then he's attaching my name to something I didn't say, and I have a problem with that. So that's why most people usually call on the show. They usually say the previous caller. because then it just leaves its mask, you know, it's that way, you know, whatever. But I understand the family atmosphere, and, you know, like I said, if I don't mind saying one time, but...
Well, you're getting a little... You're getting a little...
Like it's a personal attack at that point.
Well, I can assure you that it's not. This is the disagreement between people who agree and on the direction they want the country to go, and they're disagreeing on how they get there. And that's a profound, at least to my way of seeing it, Gary, that's a profound difference. There's a profound difference between that and saying, no, we're going in different directions. I offer you, for instance, Andy, who writes in tonight, and he says Gary just doesn't get it. He says at least Bush ruled to his base. Bush pushed legislation to fire up his base, such as privatizing Social Security. Obama does things to outrage and antagonize his base. And he also says, in a sense of fairness, note that Bill Clinton had another advantage. The economy was on fire. It was doing great. In Obama's case, it's in the toilet. The worst economy since the Great Depression. And he refers me to an article, and he says, according to the author, it's over and Obama failed. You can't win when your own base is hurting really badly and yet gets thrown no bones. And Andy argues
our base.
I'm sorry?
I've been arguing that I believe our base is not the left. I believe our base is actually partially the center.
Well, and Andy kind of addresses that, and he says, by the way, we're a left country. We're a left people. It's just not shown by the people ruling us who do not listen to their constituents. And, you know, there's an argument to be made for that, Gary, because of the way that what does exist in this country. We have, you know...
Why they keep voting? Why they talking about putting the Republicans back in 18 months if they drove in the ditch?
Well, explain and explain to me why that headline said... Almost optimistically, almost 50% of people strongly disagree with privatizing Social Security. And what I mean by that, Gary, is to suggest that we have left word, I'm kind of waffling, but we have left word inclinations in this country. No country that has anything like Social Security, can consider itself rightward. No country that has unemployment compensation. No country that has Medicaid and Medicare. No country that provides fire and police services to everybody as a function of tax payment and not an individual fee structure. No country that has arguably viable roads. These are all functions of a leftward country that has been more leftward than it is now. But the difference lies in the fact that no matter how leftward all of that is, we have a rightward, professional, for-profit media structure. And I'm sorry to come back to my little bete noire, but it doesn't matter how leftward we are if the media structure is constantly screaming center right, center right, center right, center right. You see what I'm saying?
I see that. But like I said before, I was in the DNC and I worked with. And I've been out there with people, and what I've seen is more of a people who, once they understand the issues at the core, definitely are left. But on the main surface structural thinking level, it's a center country. You know, that shows in voting, and that's the problem. Where it's clear on the Republican side, it's clearly the extreme. You know, so I understand why George Bush would play to it. You know, so I understand it clearly for their base. But to me, if we had a base, it seems like we would have more power. And I just don't buy that we actually have a left base. Now, you call it professional left, whatever you want to call it, whatever. But I haven't really seen a powerful structure enough to say we actually have a strong base on the left side. And I really think that we are probably misreading that. That's just, again, my opinion. I think we're going to disagree on a couple things tonight because, like I said before, I do think it was elevated to personal attack because I listened to the show. But like I said before, I'll leave it at that.
All right, Gary, great call. Thank you a lot. I appreciate your ideas.
Okay.
All right, take care. Bye now. And let's see, about 27 before the hour, and we're going to go right along. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. It's Megan.
Hey, Megan. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm just now rolling into my home right now. Did you get my email earlier today?
Yes, I did.
I don't know how I feel about them moving into my state, trying to back a candidate who, I found out today, she accused her opponents of, like, following her around to her house and, accused, like, she was caught in two lies of, like, accusing Mike Castle of being found with another man and making all sorts of accusations about the votes that she got back in 08 when she ran against Biden. And, frankly, it just kind of wigs me out just a little bit.
And you're talking about Senate candidate Christine O'Donnell.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sorry, against Mike Castle.
Right, and she's a teabagger, right?
Yes. And the Tea Party movement is apparently pouring a whole lot of money into her campaign to try to oust Castle because they're upset with Castle's moderate voting record. On top of which, I haven't seen a whole lot of his campaign commercials from 2 years ago, but I saw one on TV just the other night where he's talking about he's going with the line of we got to stop Washington spending, and I'm like okay. So I actually looked at his went to his website and looked at his voting record. He actually, unless I'm mistaken, I think he voted for the health care reform bill that went through.
Yeah, he did, and he's catching hell for it.
Are the Republicans really kind of shooting themselves in the foot by getting rid of the moderates in their own party?
They don't think so. They want an ideologically pure party of absolutely frothing at the mouth, rabid anarcho-Randians.
I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, do they really think the numbers are there to support it? And I'm not just talking about one or two candidates. I'm talking about, I mean, they're clearly they're going across the country trying to support whoever they can to get into, to get in on or get voted in by this November.
Well, see, I equate this woman a little bit with Looney Tunes like Sharon Angle and Jan Brewer. This is stuff that even 10 or 15 years ago would have disqualified as a person, disqualified a person as an as a legitimate candidate for office. You know, saying that, oh, wow, you know, my political opponents are hiding at the bush in the bushes, and I have they're stalking me. Really? I mean, that's a little bit like when Ross Perot said that the Martians tried to abduct his kid. You know, and everybody was riding along with Ross for a little while. They did what, Ross? Oh, never mind. So hopefully that's what happens here. I find myself in an odd position of, you know, rooting for the normal guy and rooting for the normal guy in the primary. I don't know. I'd rather see a Democrat win the seat.
Well, up here, I'm supporting a candidate that, and I looked at the Delaware Democratic website, and they had it linked to all the candidates that were running, and I'm supporting the one candidate that actually put on his platform the environment, where he actually stated he wanted to move away from coal and oil and natural gas. And you know, I don't expect it to happen overnight, but he said he wants to move in that direction. And some of the other candidates were like, oh, we need to stop Obamacare, and we need to do this. And you know, I'm like, guys, are you really paying attention? You know, because just even the word Obamacare just kind of, like, it makes me grimace. It's somehow not being aware of what's going on with the healthcare system in our country, you know, with someone that at least...
Right, but you have to understand, Megan, when you hear right-wingers... blabbing about Obamacare, You got to understand. That's only because they can't call it Schlesinger word care. You know what the Schlesinger word is, right?
Yeah.
Okay. If they could call it that word care, they would. They really would. Because that's how they think of him. That in our White House.
You know, to be honest with you, Bob, I really have not understood the sudden rise of the Tea Party movement. Call me naive, but the whole thing with the race, I think, might be kind of filling in the blanks for me, but unfortunately, I don't see it.
Well, it has to. It has to. You got to understand, Megan, the teabagging movement was born out of the militia movement, out of the movement to be... the people who ran off into the hills and played with guns, you know, the same crowd that got all worked up about Waco and Ruby Ridge, they're in the teabagging movement. If you go and you look on YouTube for the Second Amendment rally in Kentucky for Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, they're all there. There's a Facebook page of just countless teabagging signs from teabagging protests all over the country. There's even one that uses the Schlesinger word.
Oh, my God.
My God, you know, the teabagger in Georgia who has, you know, Curious George Obama dolls for sale, the carnival operator who encouraged people to come to the shooting gallery on his midway and take pot shots at a standing figure of Obama as an alien.
I thought the one where he was to be honest, the one where they had him as the Joker from the Dark Knight movie. I originally thought that was like the blackface in reverse.
Okay, see? You've got it. They can talk about what they think they stand for, but at the end of the day, if Barack Obama was not a dark-skinned man of mixed race, they wouldn't have 90% of them wouldn't be there. The genius of Dick Armey and Freedom Works and the rest of the AstroTurf front groups, or the AstroTurf K Street lobby groups that have put together the teabaggers, is that they understand far better than liberals or progressives do how deep racism still runs in this country, and they have tapped into it with a pipe that's 30 miles wide.
Playing with fire, though, and if you do that at some point, isn't it going to blow up in your face? That's the thing that scares me the most, is seeing all that being riled up, especially by the likes of Glenn Beck, who, as we found out with the Muslim cabbie stabbing, basically they're going to sit back and say, oh, well, we can't be blamed for this. And I'm sitting here like, so innocent people are going to get hurt because you're basically riling up a mob that's going to be stupid enough to take you seriously.
But, Megan, what you got to understand is it's not going to blow up in their faces. It's going to blow up in yours. And it's going to blow up in mine. You know, I'm going to say the word as loathsome as I find it, but I will never forget the day a couple of years ago, or almost 2 years ago, when my children came home and got off the bus and said, Daddy, they called us nigger lovers on the bus today because of our Obama sign.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, I know these kids' parents. And you know what? They're just as nice when you talk to them. Oh, my God. Oh, God bless you. Why don't you come to church on Sundays?
Oh, my God. My experience wasn't quite as bald-faced, but it was, you know, at first it was, oh, I don't like him, he doesn't have enough experience, or, you know, now it's, you know, one reason after another, and I'm looking at this going, so what are you really trying to say? I guess I answer my own question. I mean, this is,
It's tough to stomach. It's okay. Don't feel bad, Megan.
I'm just worried. I'm seriously worried about the atmosphere come, not even 2 months down the road. What are we going to be dealing with if they're taking guns to the town hall meetings they had about the health care?
Yeah.
They're taking guns there. Am I going to have to face someone who's trying to intimidate me at the voting booth when I go to cast my vote?
You know what? The only thing you can arm yourself on that day, Megan, is the number of your state secretary of state's office or whoever your ballot, you know, whoever handles elections in Delaware. And you take your cell phone with you. And the minute that somebody does that, you take their picture and you call the number.
But, seriously, is that what we're headed for in terms of...
It depends on where you are. I mean, if Delaware is crawling with teabaggers right now because you've only got one member of the House, you're the second smallest state in the union. It's relatively easy to campaign in. If that's what you're facing right now, don't be surprised but what I suspect that they will do earlier on is dirty tricks. They are, after all, whether we call them tea partiers, tea baggers, or whatever, the tea patriots, they're Republicans. And Republicans specialize, Megan, in dirty tricks at election time.
Well, we saw that, 10 years ago? That was the first presidential election I got to vote in. And I sat there and watched basically tell, some counties in Florida that their votes didn't count. And I'm sitting here thinking, yeah, I'm 21 years old. I was like, if they can say that to the, X number of counties in Florida, then... who else is he going to say that to? And I had 8 years to get my answer. And it turns out my gut instinct was right. So now I guess the question is, how far are we going to let this go? You know what I mean? It's not...
But, the fact of the matter is, Megan, the question is not how far we're going to let this go. The only thing we can do is beat them at the ballot box. Ultimately, the question is, how far is the for-profit media going to let this go? Because the teabaggers are the darlings of the for-profit media.
I'm seeing a whole lot of three-ring circus stuff going on, and to me... It's like watching Evel Knievel, do his high jumps, for so long, and the crowd's egging him on. And I'm sitting here thinking either someone's going to get hurt, something's going to get broken, or both. And I fully intend to go to the ballot box. That's not the question. It's just, at this point, somebody's going to get hurt, and somebody already has. That's the only thing that worries me. Big time is that it's headed past.
And understand that organizations like Radio Rwanda, otherwise known as Fox News, are anxiously hoping that more teabaggers start shooting because, man, is that some fun news to cover. If it bleeds, it leads.
And unfortunately, that's a pretty sick way of looking at it. Because.
Oh, it is sick. I didn't say it was healthy, it's just very real.
What was it? Last night's show that you were talking about. You were talking about the shooter in the Discovery Channel and his manifesto, and you had read it to us. And then the actual clip from Fox News where they're mentioning Al Gore, and I was sitting there thinking, where did they drag Al Gore into this?
I haven't found it yet, and you know what? The Horn family is very good at finding stuff, and I take it from the fact that they haven't found it either. That it was something that was invented inside of the fevered brain of people like Charlotte Mizowitz, who sent out that blast email in the first place.
So basically, it was was a generalization by someone because he kept talking about on this planet, and I guess they, in their minds, planet equals environment, environment equals Al Gore, Al Gore equals his little film about climate change.
Yeah, God is love, love is blind, Ray Charles is blind, therefore God is Ray Charles. Exactly. That's how the right-wing mind operates. But the thing is, the people at Radio Rwanda, Megan, their minds are perfectly good. But they know right down to the last firing neuron how the average right-wing mind that watches the Radio Rwanda operates. And they know that they can lead them by the nose with false comparisons like that, and that they will buy it lock, stock, and barrel because Rush Limbaugh told them that Fox News is fair and balanced. See how it works?
I had a history teacher back from when I was in high school who was dead set against Rush Limbaugh. And there was an actual book that I actually had held in my hands dedicated to undoing everything Rush Limbaugh said. And it was just like the Glenn Beck rally. We were like, yeah, if I have to go through every historical detail that he is mentioning in his speech, it would take me like 6 months to go through the first 5 minutes. That kind of misinformation at one point, I would have loved to have taken a poll of every person that was at that rally, find out what their annual income was, whether they were employed, and whether they had health insurance.
Well, my God, did you not hear the did you not hear the one? I don't know. There's some clips out there, and they're not anything that you want to watch if you're in a fun mood. But there are clips out of people there at Beckstock or White Stock or whatever it was. And they say these crazy things, Megan, like, well, it just come out on the news the other day that we Americans ain't allowed to pray to the Lincoln Memorial no more.
Oh, my God.
And the interviewer says, well, where did you hear that? On the news. And somewhere in that fevered little zealous mind, some tiny little tapioca-like wad of misinformation has lodged and grown like something out of a sci-fi horror movie and created in her mind the idea that she can't pray to the Lincoln Memorial no more. And there she was at it, but you know what? She loved her rights and she's going to defend her rights. But she didn't go up there to pray, and there was praying aplenty going on. Yeah, well, exactly. You see the problem. Megan, it's been a wonderful call, but I got to roll along because we're fast running out of time.
All right. Talk to you later, Bob.
Okay, you have a good night.
All right, you too.
Bye now. And again, a gentle reminder that the reason we do have to run along is simply because Rick Smith is on his way in a matter of, oh, goodness gracious, about 8 minutes. And by the way, the essay over there at Bourdain Medium Raw is climbing up the charts. We've got 14 votes now. Remember, you can vote every day, which is cool. So please do so. It would be kind of fun to see the Horn family wield a little bit of a little bit of influence. Those little things that tell us what we can do, those are magic moments. So let's go to the back to the phones for one more call before we're out of here. Hey, welcome to the program.
Okay, it's the traditional last time caller there, the last the end of the show.
Hey, Brian.
And that's about as much time people want to give to Brian there.
Oh, now quit that.
Okay, but I wanted to say first of all that yesterday was Labor Day, of course, but there's the news out of Iraq there, the American government there with this. Mr. Maliki is still ostensibly in charge of the Iraqi government. Their parliament can't elect a new government, but they've shut down the Iraqi unions, basically, especially electrical utility workers in Basra. They have the first woman union leader named Hashmaya Musan, and her offices were shut down there recently, very late August. And the fact that, I can imagine as bad as things are for the American labor union movement and workers there, it's still it can't be nearly as bad as this for the Iraqi workers there under a colonial occupation of the United States government, let's face it. And one last thing, Bob, I'm wondering about the health care bill. It was still being touted even after they passed the health care reform under Obama there earlier this year, but the H.R. 676 bill, is that still possible to... They can ameliorate these bills together, you know, and could bring them together some over the future if we can keep the Democratic Congress, that is, especially the House of Representatives, where these bills get started usually. Is H.R. 676 still a viable possibility?
I think it always can be. I mean, of course, we're coming to the end of a Congress, so everything has to start over afresh.
Yeah, and that's what the main thing is. Everybody, please get. I'm an agoraphobic, and I'm throwing myself out the door. Get out there for your local Democratic candidate and canvas and phone bank and all that later in the day when people you traditionally get home and that kind of thing. But get out there for your Democratic candidate, please, folks. It's not just for the Horn family. It's for the family, the civilization called America. We let these teabaggers and these fascists and corporatists, we let these bastards win there. It'll be very much it's like letting the SA win, and then who really wins is the SS and Hitler. That's the corporations and the real power elite in this country. They're the Rand Pauls and the Alan Greenspans, the libertarians that get away with the biggest tax increase in history on Social Security tax, and they won't pay it out. They steal from its surpluses from the American worker there, but everybody else gets their full retirement. Alan Greenspan gets his full retirement there, his six-figure retirement for his criminal rule as the Fed chairman, their chief. But we can't let these bastards win in November. Have a good night, sir.
All right. Take care, Brian. Thanks for all of that.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
You know what that says? That says a boatload. I'm not going to offer any commentary. But Brian just described himself. He said, I'm agoraphobic and I'm throwing myself out the door to go and work on this. I wish some member of Congress was listening and could have heard that. I wish some member of Congress out there had a functioning idea of what it takes for us out here to do for them to get so godforsaken little in return. And we don't ask much. Fast running out of time, but I don't know if you saw this story last week. It merited mention. You know, this is just one of those stories. There are a million stories in the Naked Nation. Well, this is one of them. I don't know how many times on this program I've played Little Feet. Well, Richie Hayward was a co-founder of that magnificent band. And Richie Hayward is dead. Richie Hayward died at the relatively, for modern purposes, young age of 64. He had liver cancer. He died in early August. He was waiting on a liver when pneumonia set in and took him. Here's the punchline, if you will. He had no health insurance. And we know about Richie Hayward because Richie Hayward was somebody who meant something to the music that means something to us. But we ask so godforsaken little of our elected representatives, just that the people we love and who are near and dear to us don't die wanting minimal health care, or don't die wanting a liver, or don't die from pneumonia. That our loved ones don't die simply from neglect. And if not neglect, then that the people we care about don't die because the other side is so god-awful evil. We ask so little of our elected representatives. So very little. Just that they don't let the evil win, and that they fight as hard against the evil as the evil is willing to fight against them. In the grand scheme of things, that's just not a hell of a lot. It's Rick Smith time. Thanks, everybody.